information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care,
appear to border
and it shows.
On
the law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
This is the scariest weekend I can think of in a long, long time, my friends. The trifecta of the ensuing police state, the new financial world order, and the presidential selection all swirling around Halloween weekend and the last day for an official October surprise. You're tuned in to a very special episode of Media Monarchy. It's episode 98, and it's October 31st, 2008. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Tons to go over this week. Like we said, Selection 08, Police State, USA, the new financial world order, vote fraud, bribe brawls, We Are Change, Naomi Wolf, hoax attacks, money masters, and the Rothschilds, and tons more. It's all here, my friends, on episode 98 of MediaMonarchy.com. This day, anything goes. An oldie but a goodie from the Misfits, Halloween, appropriately enough. My friends, welcome to this special 3-hour episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's fortunate for me, my man DJ Cliff wasn't able to make it into the Portland Radio Authority this morning, so I'm coming in an hour early because it's going to take 3 hours to go through all the wonderful, horrible news that's swirling around us. So once again, let me tell you, my name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. It's episode 98, and it's Halloween 2008. Coming to you live every Friday morning from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7, revereradionetwork.com. Also, thanks to KBFR in Boulder and 87.9 Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta for rebroadcasting Media Monarchy. And you can hit me up and make contact a number of ways. MySpace, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, Skype, all with Media Monarchy as your keyword, as well as radioforall.net, iTunes, and archive.org. Put up an episode yesterday, the B-side of episode 97. It was an amazing in-depth investigation into the 70th anniversary of Orson Welles, H.G. Wells, and the War of the Worlds PSYOP. So you gotta go check that out. Plus, tons of other news about Karl Rove and Judith Miller and UK UFO files and Scientology and the latest E. Howard Hunt revelations. So be sure to hop back and pick up the B-side of 97. So, now, let's do it. Let's get into it. We're gonna be all over the place because there's a lot to go over. But I think you can do it. You're going to stick with me. I think I can keep it moving for you. So let's kick it off with one of the bigger stories yesterday on the 30th. This coming from Paul Joseph Watson, as well as Yihan Dai. It's Yihan Dai. I believe that's Paul Joseph Watson's Chinese girlfriend, and she aided in some of the translations that are contained in this story. Rand lobbies Pentagon, saying, start a war to save the U.S. economy. According to reports out of top Chinese mainstream news outlets, the Rand Corporation, R-A-N-D, think tank extraordinaire, recently presented a shocking proposal to the Pentagon in which it lobbied for a war to be started with a major foreign power in an attempt to stimulate the American economy and prevent a recession. It's a little late for that second one. A fierce debate has now ensued in China about who that foreign power may be, with China itself, as well as Russia and even Japan, suspected to be the targets of aggression. The reports cite French media news sources as having uncovered the proposal in which Rand suggested that the $700 billion that has been earmarked to bail out Wall Street and failing banks instead be used to finance a new war, which would in turn reinvigorate the flagging stock markets. The Rand Corporation is a notoriously powerful non-governmental organization with deep ties to the U.S. military-industrial complex, as well as interlocking connections with the Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie Foundations. Much like our two presidential puppet selectees. Moving to a story from Raw Story, as well as the ACLU Constitution Free Zone within 100 miles from the border of the United States. Now you have to look at this photo of the border that goes around 100 miles from within, and that surely includes where I am sitting in the Pacific Northwest in Portland, Oregon. And if I squint enough, it almost looks like it would even contain the town I moved here from, Shepherdstown, West Virginia. The ACLU says a constitution-free zone exists within 100 miles of the U.S. border, where the Department of Fatherland Security claims the authority to stop, search, and detain anyone for any reason. Nearly two-thirds of the U.S. population lives within 100 miles of the border, according to the ACLU, and the border zone encompasses scores of major metropolitan areas and even entire states. If we fly over to Hawaii and the Honolulu Advertiser, one of our brief, bright rays of good news here. Army can't retry Lieutenant Aaron Watata for refusal to serve in the Iraq War. A federal judge ruled that the Army cannot retry First Lieutenant Aaron Watata, W-A-T-A-D-A, the Kalani High graduate who was the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse deployment to the war in Iraq on the main charges against him. Watata was charged with missing his Fort Lewis, Washington Stryker Brigade's deployment and with conduct unbecoming an officer. He refused to board a flight to the Middle East in June 2006. The 30-year-old soldier contended that the war is illegal and that he would be party to war crimes if he served in Iraq. His first court-martial ended in a mistrial in February 2007. Watata's father, Bob, said, quote, it's obviously good news. It's very good news. And we've been following the Aaron Watata story for quite some time. I believe if we jump back to February of 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com, We can read about some of the earlier developments of conscientious objector. Or, actually, that's not exactly true. Aaron Watada isn't exactly an anti-war guy. He's just at least realized that the war in Iraq is a complete erroneous, genocidal swath of bullshit lies. The Georgia Bulletin, by way of alexconstantine.blogspot.com, Catholics seek support for probe of Fort Benning School. Do you know what that is, boys and girls? 10 years after a Catholic archbishop in Guatemala was beaten to death for his work on human rights, four Atlanta priests, two sisters, and seven local members of the Catholic peace group Pax Christi are calling on Congress to deepen its investigation of the controversial Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, which one of his killers attended. The activists believe the Department of Defense-funded military school based at Fort Benning in Columbus, in Georgia, formerly known as the School of the Americas. They believe the DOD-funded School of the Americas is linked to human right violators in Latin America who target the poor and clergy who speak up for them. They want Congress to enact a law that would suspend the military school until a commission reports on what tactics students were taught that violated international law or United States law and hold accountable those who drafted and approved those teaching manuals. And there are a lot of links in there. There have been a lot of exposés on the School of the Americas, even down to a documentary narrated by Susan Sarandon, which I believe is up on Google Video and linked up for you. If we move to the UK and the Daily Mail, a former CIA man died after the volume of an alarm on his hospital heart monitor was turned down. American Alan Bell, it's B-E-L, age 60, suffered a heart attack, but medics failed to notice because they were not alerted because they could not hear the alarm. Consultant cardiologist Dr. Bernard Clark told the inquest that, quote, on the balance of the probabilities, staff could have saved the 60-year-old if the machine had been working. Whoops. So it's always suspicious when a CIA guy bites it. This, perhaps not quite as suspicious as the Roland Carnaby case of several months ago, tied in perhaps with the DC Madam or perhaps with some major false flag event in Houston. Speculation abounds from Wayne Madsen and others. There's a video, but it's in French, of comic Jean-Marie Bigard, B-I-G-A-R-D. If you'll recall, a few weeks ago, we mentioned him in relation to Nicolas Sarkozy. Not only is he one of France's biggest comedians, whatever that means, he's also good buddies with relatively new French president Nicolas Sarkozy. However, he knows that 9/11 was an inside job. So he's done an interview and the video is up and it's him basically talking about the brouhaha about talking about 9/11. Again, that's always the theme, and we're going to see it again and again and again in this episode, as, of course, the political circus reaches its heights, or depths, as the case may be. Remember, the way we do things here, we don't talk about the issues, we talk about how I don't like how you're talking about the issues. If we move to the Record, this is out of Waterloo, and this is by way of 911blogger.com. U.S. professor will bring hidden history of 9/11 to the University of Waterloo. A U.S. professor who questions the official version of what happened on 9/11 will speak next month at the University of Waterloo. Paul Zaremka, Zaremka, Paul Zaremka, economics professor at the State University of New York at Buffalo, is editor of The Hidden History of 9/11, an ongoing journal, with a link for you. He will speak about studies done at UW and the University of Toronto on terrorist attacks in New York City and discuss whether the U.S. government told the truth about the events. So that's coming up on November 13th, and that is, of course, thanks to the UW 9/11 Research Group, with links for you, and we'll probably follow that one up. Now, my friends, if we jump to truthnews.us, we've been hearing more and more from folks like Naomi Wolf, who are basically regular mainline progressive Democrats who have slowly, a little too slowly, been waking up to the fraud of what's been going around, that it's not just the Bush administration. We're going to get some change, my friends. Believe them both. Naomi Wolf, author of the new book, Give Me Liberty, Handbook for Young Revolutionary. We Are Change Los Angeles and the awesome Stuart Howe and others sat down at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena, California to talk to Naomi Wolf, where, among other things, she says, "I have questions about 9/11, just like any other thoughtful citizen does."
I'm here with Naomi Wolf at Vroman's in Pasadena to ask what she would like to say to Truth and Accountability Women.
Hey, hi. So what I want to say is, I don't have a theory that explains what happened on 9/11, but this is what I do know. Based on what the founders intended America to be, there should be no questions that citizens ask that are beyond the pale. Citizens should be able to ask any question. If they have questions about 9/11, their elected officials should be accountable to them. I'm aware that the commissioners of the 9/11 report disavowed their own conclusions in the New York Times, and if they disavow their conclusions because the conclusions were based on evidence derived from torture, then there should be another investigation. I live 10 blocks from Ground Zero, and I know that I had questions as a citizen as the events were unfolding. I know that this administration is capable of hurting Americans liberally because they lied to us in Lower Manhattan. They sent Christy Whitman to say that the air is safe to breathe, and my son Joey now has respiratory disease, as do many kids in Lower Manhattan who took off their masks because of this administration, so they are capable of hurting citizens. So I would say to the Truth Accountability Movement that I respect their effort to find out for themselves, and I respect their spirit as citizens to not be silenced in terms of the questions that they have.
Thank you. We very much appreciate and respect your efforts as well. And without speculating on any theories, is there anything about the events of the day of 9/11 that just sort of didn't add up? Anything at all that you find questionable that you would ask the questions to?
I think every thoughtful citizen has noticed things that might raise questions. I'll just tell you that I met a firefighter last 2 nights ago in Seattle who started a Firefighters 9/11 Truth organization, and I have to say, just as a citizen, I trust the firefighters. I trust that they don't have an agenda, so if they have questions, it leads me to think that, legitimate citizens have legitimate questions.
Well, it's been wonderful meeting you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Thanks,
thank
Naomi.
Take care.
Naomi Wolf, with questions like any other thoughtful citizen should have about 9/11 and many, many other things. That whole video is up there for you. WeAreChangeLA.org. One of numerous updates from DailyDoseOfTerror.blogspot.com. Just give you one headline and a link. Terror Twitter tool. Japanese war games and terror drills, Russia and the expanding global war on terror. The GWAT. Or the global war of terror, if you like. If we jump now to the first of sure many, many times to come from one of the two best blogs up on Wired.com, Threat Level and right now, Danger Room. Marines and Army get ready to wield stun guns. The Marine Corps has been buying tasers for years, but the military has only used the stun guns sparingly in the field. Now, all that is set to change thanks to new training guidelines for the electroshock weapons. Which they ask the uncouth question, what's Arabic for don't tase me, bro? We would expect the use of devices such as the taser to grow over time. Now that we have this long-term policy in place, Major David Nevers tells the Marine Corps Times. Another one from DailyDoseOfTerror.blogspot.com. We've got more on Lockheed Martin, post-election threataganda, and more on Russia and China. But back to the homeland, Stasi land, from the Washington Post, the CIA's favorite newspaper, Metro to randomly search writers' bags. Now, if you've never been to Washington, D.C., my friends here in Portland, the Metro is a lot like the MAX. It's a nice, clean, quiet, smooth, light rail that does not run 24/7. But I digress. Again, from the Washington Post, Metro officials announced plans to immediately begin random searches of backpacks, purses, and other bags in a move they say will protect riders and also guard their privacy and minimize delays. The program is modeled after one begun 3 years ago in New York that has withstood legal challenges. So that's the bar that you set. Well, it hasn't been ruled unconstitutional yet, so bend over, bitch. However, experts said it's difficult to measure the effectiveness of such searches beyond assuring the public that police are being vigilant. Or vigilantes. New York officials declined to say what they have found in their searches. None of the other transit systems conducting random searches have found any explosives, officials said. Metro officials said the program was not in response to a specific threat, but prompted by increased security concerns before next week's selection and the inauguration, as well as by, of course, 9/11 and later bombings of commuter trains, like on 311 and 77 and other false flag inside black ops. Speaking of insiders, our friends from Science Applications International Corporation, one of the biggest and baddest of the private military contractors. I subscribe to their feed for their press releases, so anytime one of them grabs my attention, I post them up. So this from the PMC's mouth: SAIC wins $226 million contract for CENTCOM support. SAIC announced it has been awarded a task order to provide information technology support and services to the U.S. Central Command's Directorate of Command and Control Communications and Computers. That's J6. Those are the guys who run terror drills like Vigilant Guardian and Top Off. The task order has a one-year base period of performance with 4 one-year options and a blah-bitty-blah-blah. There's links in there. You can read more about CENTCOM and J6 and SAIC. If we jump to the Phoenixville News out of Pennsylvania, they're mulling installing audio surveillance in school buses. Bus companies and school districts would be allowed to record audio on school buses under legislation that would modify the state's wiretapping and surveillance law, and supporters say help deter unruly student behavior. Some buses already use silent video cameras, but questions have arisen about whether recording sound violates the law, which requires the consent of the person being recorded. State Representative Don Walko, W-A-L-K-O, Democrat of Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, said his legislation would allow school boards to authorize audio taping while requiring notification of students and parents and placing signs on buses stating audio taping is taking place. So again, more surveillance police state measures from your good friends, the progressives, the Democrats. In 2006, state police asked Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Zapala Jr. to determine whether Laidlaw Transit Incorporated had illegally audiotaped students on buses in two districts. Zapala found Laidlaw had no intent to break the law and said he wouldn't prosecute bus audiotaping cases if they followed the requirements now part of Walco's legislation. Of course, Laidlaw has changed their name. I believe they're now First Student, and they're getting cameras and audio recording on all their buses, including Oregon. We covered that a couple weeks ago. If we move to the New York Post, and it's always, always about the paid provocateur informants. Whenever there are these massive terror busts on the front page, you'll find that in the weeks and months coming, you'll find out that they don't have that much evidence, but they do have a well-paid informant that was inside the group for a long time, prodding and provocateuring usually a group of dipshits into doing something or talking about something or videotaping themselves talking about maybe doing something. Being an informant for the FBI in the Fort Dix 6 terror investigation has paid well, a witness explained to jurors. John Sturmel, STEREMEL, an investigator assigned to an FBI counterterrorism task force, spent the morning on the stand detailing the role of informant Mahmoud Omar, who wore a wire for 16 months in the investigation of five men accused of planning to shoot soldiers at the army base. Defense lawyers say it was Omar who tried to plot an attack, not their clients. And we see it all the time. Informants. 9/11 hijackers living with FBI informants. Give me a fucking break. Staying in New York, the Schenectady Daily Gazette: White House pushes for local schools to drug test students. The White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, whitehousedrugpolicy.gov, is hoping to convince local school districts and educators to randomly drug test students. It's a movement that is sweeping the country and gaining support in many states, and advocates say it provides students a, quote, credible reason to say no to drug use. That's an interesting way to put it. Here is a credible reason to say no to drug use, because we know that Nancy Reagan and all that just say no bullshit only makes kids more interested in drugs, and the prohibition of drugs that the PMCs and the military industrial complex bring into this country and then arrest you for using. Kind of like in the movie Scanner Darkly, you know, the illegal drug, and they bust you for it, and then you find yourself working on the farm that makes more drugs that they sell to bust you. So it's a credible reason to say no to drug use. So, you know, you're not buying all the anti-drug bullshit. So how about a reason of being you're going to get piss tested, you little slave? How about that? Department of Energy tests river for contaminants from nuke program. This from McClatchy. Workers are collecting samples along the Columbia River in Washington State to test for contaminants linked to past production of plutonium for the nation's nuclear weapons program. After the sampling, we'll know where and what the contaminants are and who or what might be exposed to them, says Jamie Zeesloft, who's leading the testing for the Department of Energy, energy.gov. Returning to Danger Room, military investigates amnesia beans. And this is a long article, and it has a lot of links and a nice photo of the men in black referencing, of course, you know, their little pin beam that would blank out your mind. A team of scientists from the United States and China announced last week that, for the first time, they had found a means of selectively and safely erasing memories in mice. Using the signaling molecule, some long string of letters and symbols that I can't pronounce, but it's there for you. It's a big step forward and one that will be of considerable interest to the military, which has devoted efforts to memory manipulation as a means of treating post-traumatic stress disorder. I bet they found some other uses for it as well. Manchurian! But some military research has moved in another direction entirely. In the 1980s, research found that even low-level exposure to a beam of electrons caused rats to forget what had just happened to them, an effect known as retrograde amnesia. The other version, anti-retrograde amnesia, is when you can't form new memories. The same effect was also achieved with X-rays. The time factor was not large. It only caused memory loss for about the previous 4 seconds, but the effect was intriguing. One theory was that the amnesia was a result of the brilliant flash experience when the electron beam struck the retina, and indeed it turned out that it's possible to produce amnesia in rodents using a flash of light. And like I said, there's lots of disturbing military links right in there for you, so you can read more about the new military amnesia beams, or the men in black mind erasers. If we move to North Dakota, which I don't recommend, but the Minot Daily News reports that the Minot Air Force Base B-52s have deployed to Guam to take part in a war games exercise. You'll recall our good friends from the Minot Air Force Base flew 6 nuclear warheads across the United States to Barksdale in Louisiana. B-52 aircrews from Minot Air Force Base deployed to Guam recently finished a flying exercise this month over the Pacific Alaska Range Complex. The exercise tested their ability to defend against air threats. A 10-day joint exercise, Red Flag Alaska 09-1. Also includes B-52s from the aforementioned Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana and F-16 Fighting Falcons from Kunsan Air Force Base in the Republic of Korea and Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks, Alaska. KC-135s for air refueling from McConnell Air Force Base in Kansas also participated, according to the 354th Fighter Wing Public Affairs at Eielson Air Force Base. Watch the war games and terror drills. Pakistan says to the U.S., call off your killer drones. This, again, from Danger Room. Since the start of August, U.S. drones have struck targets in Pakistan at least 19 times. The latest attack, one of the deadliest ever, killed 20. Now, Pakistani officials say they've had fucking enough of the robot planes and are demanding that America call off its killer drones, quote, immediately. The drone attacks have negative repercussions when the Pakistani government tries to get the support of the people in the tribal area. That said by Foreign Ministry spokesman Mohammad Sadiq, S-A-D-I-Q, telling the New York Times. Again, quote, they're not helping meet the objectives of the GWAT. Such attacks are a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty and should be stopped immediately, the ministry added in a statement. The American military stepped up its unmanned aerial vehicle, UAV, assaults in Pakistan on Pakistan, in part because of local government complaints over manned attacks on militant camps inside the country. Local media reports say that 301 civilians have been killed this year in American strikes, both conventional and robotic. So, basically, after complaints of manned attacks, the military said, okay, we'll just send over drones piloted by video game-loving teenagers. Back over the pond to The Guardian. Witness says the police did not warn Jean-Charles de Menzies before opening fire. Jean-Charles de Menzies was not warned before he was shot dead by police, three witnesses told the inquest. That claim contradicts the police account that the innocent Brazilian was warned before being shot. Ralph Livock, L-I-V-O-C-K, and his girlfriend Rachel Wilson were sitting in a tube carriage opposite the 27-year-old Brazilian. Nicholas Hilliard, QC, counsel to the inquest, asked him if he heard the police shout a warning. Absolutely not. And I remember that specifically because one of the conversations that Rachel and I had afterwards was that we had no idea whether they were police, whether they were terrorists, whether they were somebody else. We just had no idea. Which fits. You can't tell the police apart from the terrorists because generally there is no difference. A quick little reminder, Jean-Charles de Menzies killed July 22nd, 2005, 722. Remember, this is in the aftermath of 7/7. He was a Brazilian national living in the Tulse Hill area of South London. Menzies was shot dead at Stockwell Tube Station on the London Underground by unnamed Metropolitan Police officers. Initially, witness reports in the media incorrectly claimed that he was wearing bulky clothing and that he had vaulted the ticket barriers running from police. A police spokesman said on that day, quote, his clothing and behavior added to their suspicions, end quote, and that he ran onto the train after police had issued warnings. It soon became clear that Menzies did not vault and run from the police, but police did not alter their statement until the correct information was leaked to the press. They later issued an apology, saying they had mistaken him for a suspect in the previous day's failed bombings, and acknowledged that Menzies, in fact, had no explosives and was unconnected with the attempted bombings. The officers involved in killing Menzies have not been charged. The jury at the corporate trial of the Metropolitan Police for violations of health and safety law attached a rare rider to the verdict that they attached, quote, no personal culpability to Deputy Assistant Commissioner Cressida Dick, the officer in charge of the operation that day. So, innocent Brazilian shot dead, broad daylight, in front of people, innocent. It's de Menzies. It's D-E-M-E-N-E-Z-E-S. I might be mispronouncing that. If we move to Time Magazine and hit the pipe, the opium pipe, and as we ask the musical questions, is the Taliban stockpiling opium? And if so, why? If international drug and law enforcement officials are right, the Taliban might be hiding up to $3.2 billion worth of opium inside Afghanistan, potentially causing huge complications for NATO's decision this month to attack Afghanistan's opium laboratories and smuggling networks. If it exists, the drug stockpile would also have a major bearing on Afghan officials' tentative peace talks with the Taliban, which are favored by CENTCOM chief David Petraeus and both U.S. presidential candidates. Warmongers, the both. Of course, a quick reminder of just a couple weeks ago, how we covered that Hamid Karzai's brother was busted, I believe, with a bunch of coke and maybe heroin, and a couple calls were made, and he was let go, and it was all over with. Drugs, my friend, drugs. They're the final letter in the real god that the elites worship. G-O-D, gold, oil, and drugs. This country has been running drugs for a long time. The money is put into the stock market, Wall Street, drug running, military-industrial complex, all connected. An amazing declaration from someone we praised mere months ago for coming out and saying that, of course, 9/11 was an intelligence operation. Everybody knows that. Now, however, still very telling statement. Now, however, former Italian President Francesco Cossiga, C-O-S-S-I-G-A, he says that we should provocateur riots, then, quote, beat the shit out of protesters. Former Italian President Francesco Cossiga has offered a solution to the Italian government in dealing with widespread demonstrations by students and teachers over a cut in state funding of education. Use agent provocateurs to start riots and then have the police, quote, beat the shit out of the protesters. Cossiga, former Italian President, Prime Minister, Minister of the Interior, and one of the founders of the Operation Gladio Covert Intelligence Unit, encouraged Silvio Berlusconi and current Minister of the Interior, Robert Maroni, to, quote, do what I did when I was the Minister of the Interior, end quote, namely infiltrate what so far have been relatively peaceful demonstrations, radicalize them, start riots, then engender public support for a heavy-handed police response. It works the same anywhere, whether it's Seattle and WTO and provocateur riots, or busting undercover Canadian police in Montebello last year for embedding themselves with protesters and trying to throw rocks and start trouble so that real peaceful protesters would then be beaten. Just another false flag op, my friends. And you should hit the links and read about Operation Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, and all that covert intel unit. Moving to Cryptagon.com, Microsoft patents web moderator robots. This is a real-time Ministry of Truth tool that can change content as it's moving over the web, with a link to the timesonline.co.uk. Filters are great as long as individuals are in control of them. For example, I don't ever want to see any stories that contain the words McCain, Obama, Biden, or Palin on Reddit. These stories waste my time. I use filtering software like userscripts.org that prevent that useless stuff from even appearing on my screen. The danger is that these types of tools could be implemented at the service provider level. No, not good. The Australians are getting a taste of this now. This Microsoft tool, rather than blocking material outright, sanitizes it midstream. And as we get slightly more in-depth into that, Australia to enforce mandatory Chinese-style internet censorship. This from Paul Joseph Watson. The Australian government is set to impose Chinese-style internet censorship by enforcing a universal national filter that will block websites deemed controversial, as part of a wider agenda to regulate the internet, according to free speech advocates. A provision whereby internet users could opt out of the filter by contacting their ISP has been stripped from the legislation, meaning the filter will be universal and mandatory. The System Administrators Guild of Australia and Electronic Frontiers Australia have attacked the proposal, saying it will restrict web access, raise prices, and slow down internet traffic. And there are links there for you to the System Administrators Guild of Australia and EFA. But if we move to the AP, this is one that kind of flew under my radar, but of course, anytime you then see the word anthrax, you go, what? FBI says the anthrax hoaxes from California Man are still in the mail, so I bookmarked that story, but when I went back, it had altered a little bit, and they had discovered that a California man suspected of mailing more than 120 hoax anthrax letters to media outlets was interviewed previously by the FBI after a similar mailing in 2007, but he was not charged. Mark M. Kaiser, K-E-Y-S-E-R 66, was interviewed by the FBI in January of 07 for allegedly sending a package containing a small aerosol can labeled anthrax, along with a compact disc, to the Sacramento News and Review newspaper, this all according to a criminal complaint filed Thursday in federal court. And there's an interesting picture of basically what looks like a press kit for anthrax. It's got the nice, you know, bubble mailer CD sleeve, print on the CD. It's got Colin Powell on the disc holding up his little vial while he was pitching his bullshit to the UN, making his phony case for war in Niger and yellow cake and bullshit. But yeah, it looks good. You should check out the photo. So again, anthrax hoaxes. More anthrax hoaxes, I should say. If we move to the New York Times, speaking of bioterror, new biolab on a Texas island worries environmentalists and locals. Much of the University of Texas Medical School on the island suffered flood damage during Hurricane Ike, except for one gleaming new building, a National Biological Defense Laboratory that will soon house some of the most deadly diseases in the world. How a laboratory where scientists plan to study viruses like Ebola and Marburg ended up on a barrier island where hurricanes regularly wreak havoc puzzles some environmentalists and community leaders. It's crazy in my mind, says Jim Blackburn, an environmental lawyer in Houston. I just find an amazing willingness among the people on the Texas coast to accept risks that a lot of people in the country would not accept. Officials at the laboratory and at the National Institutes of Health, which along with the university is helping to pay for the $174 million building, say it can withstand any storm the Atlantic hurls at it. Famous last words, and I'm sure we'll see prepped bio releases coming from them. Again, whether it's Lyme disease at Plum Island or foot and mouth at Porton Down and Pierbright. Whoops. Sorry we resurrected the 1918 Spanish flu and let it loose. Here you go. And again, you find out it was always during some sort of drill. Again, from the Associated Press, gophers dig way to flu shot record. Gophers being the mascot of the University of Minnesota, which thinks it has jabbed its way into the record books. More than 60 trained personnel dispensed 11,538 flu shots during a 9-hour period Tuesday at 4 locations around the campus in Minneapolis and St. Paul. They hope that puts them in the Guinness World Records book for the most flu shots given in a single day. The old record was 3,271, set in November 2006 in Sanford, Florida. The official number, I believe, was released on Wednesday. If we hit the StarTribune.com, I believe there's some kind of update that says that the Mayo Institute disputes their claim and no, we have the Guinness Book World Record. No, we have blah, blah, blah. Needless to say, they're all celebrating the fact that they're giving people poisonous, deadly flu shots that have very little chance of actually preventing you from getting the flu because they fucking guess at what the flu is going to be. And they give you a virus to put in your body. Take the yummy vaccines. Young girls, take Gardasil. It's good for you. On a different note, and again to Cryptogon.com, they made a killing, covert ops in the stock market. That link is there for you, but we're going to jump to BizJournals.com. Buffalo business first. General Motors stops their 401k payments in yet another sign of its financial trouble. General Motors Corporation will halt matching payments to all employees' 401k savings plans. The temporary suspension, or as the Simpsons would call it, maybe a temporary refund adjustment, which would affect all 1,340 employees at GM's engine plant in the town of Tonawanda and the automaker's entire U.S. workforce, would take effect November 1st. That would be tomorrow. The action, which a spokeswoman said is aimed at conserving cash, comes in the face of continued declining auto sales. And yes, that's about as dirty as that sounds, my friends. Finally, on the posting we've been going through with this crazy mix of news, it's been a hatful of Halloween horror stories. This last one is a funny one. Massachusetts State Senator Diane Wilkerson accepted bribes and got caught on video stuffing cash into her bra. This from ABC News and Cryptogon.com and Podblank.com. An embattled Massachusetts state senator appeared in a federal courtroom charged with taking $23,500 in bribes, including cash that she stuffed into her bra during a meeting at a Tony Boston restaurant that was secretly videotaped by an undercover FBI agent.
Senator Diane Wilkerson has been arrested on corruption charges. The Boston Democrat is accused of taking $23,500 in bribes from undercover agents who were posing as local businessmen. Wilkerson did not enter a plea and was released on $50,000 bond.
She was caught allegedly stuffing bribe money down her bra. Now State Senator Diane Wilkerson faces federal charges. She allegedly accepted more than $23,000 from undercover agents. It's an arrest that is shaking Massachusetts politics, and we have team coverage. Beginning with Fox by Diana Rocco, live in Boston. Diana.
Mark, a short time ago, State Senator Diane Wilkerson appeared before a federal judge calling these charges an all-out character assassination, but the U.S. attorney says it's all laid out right here. She has a history of corruption. This time, 8 bribes on several occasions, taking $500 to $10,000, and that could land her some hard time. Protected by her supporter, State Senator Diane Wilkerson leaves the federal courthouse caught in the act. This is a picture of the senator allegedly stuffing bribe money into her blouse.
They were FBI all over the place, and they were going in and out of the house taking pictures and talking to a lot of people.
Wilkerson was arrested in her Dorchester home this morning after an 18-month federal investigation dating back to March of last year. The FBI says the 8-term state senator took nearly $24,000 on 8 separate occasions. The payment from undercover agents and cooperating witnesses were for liquor licenses and development contracts.
The citizens of the Commonwealth deserve honest and faithful services from your elected officials, uncompromised by secret payments of cash.
Federal agents search Wilkerson's home and office as staffers leave speechless. The senator's campaign headquarters is closed. Wilkerson appeared before a judge at the federal courthouse this afternoon, charged with attempted extortion and theft of honest services. Federal officials say from June of 07 to May of 08, she took $8,500 in bribes. In exchange, she produced legislation to increase the liquor licenses in her district and pressured Boston's mayor, liquor commission, and city council by holding up legislation which would give the liquor commission raises. Wilkerson is also charged with accepting $15,000 to steer development contracts in her district to FBI agents posing as out-of-town businessmen.
Senator Diane Wilkerson is entitled to the presumption of innocence, and she cannot be found guilty until her guilt is proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
Wilkerson has a history of campaign violations dating back more than a decade and was on federal probation for not filing her taxes. Wilkerson has been released on $50,000 unsecured bond, and now if convicted, she's looking at up to 40 years in prison and $500,000 in fines. Of course, this is still a very ongoing investigation, and the feds are still asking anyone with information to come forward. We're live in Boston. I'm Diana Rocco, Fox 25 News.
Democratic corruption. But of course, it cuts both ways, both sides, completely complicit, corrupt. Diane Wilkerson busted stuffing bribes into her bra. And of course, you should watch the video so you can see the surveillance footage of said bra stuffing. Let's move to... Thank God this is all going to wrap up, at least in some way, shape, or form, in the next couple days. Selection 08. Victory, investigations, scare tactics, and a second coup. First, from Politico. McCain guarantees victory. Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, said Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press that he can, quote, guarantee a win on November 4th in a squeaker victory that won't be clear until late that night. McCain spoke amid signs of a tightening race and reports of renewed determination among his staff, which is badly outgunned in both money and manpower. Quote, I guarantee you that 2 weeks from now you will see this has been a very close race and I believe that I'm going to win it, McCain told interim Meet the Press moderator Tom Brokaw. We're going to do well in this campaign, my friend. We're going to win it, and it's going to be tight, and we're going to be up late. McCain was down just 5 points in a Reuters C-SPAN Zogby poll released Sunday with a link for you, with Obama leading by 49 to McCain's 44 among likely voters in the daily tracking poll, which has a margin of error of 2.9 points. Reuters reported that Obama's lead has dropped over the last 3 days after hitting a high of 12 points last Thursday. Pollster John Zogby said, quote, things are trending back for McCain. His numbers are rising and Obama's are dropping on a daily basis. There seems to be a direct correlation between this and McCain talking about the economy. I should have done this sooner. Let's glance at Google News on this Halloween morning. It's almost 10 o'clock Pacific time. We see gearing up for problems at polls from the Boston Globe. Wary of voter overconfidence, Obama not letting up from the Associated Press. Mixed messages on the McCain ground game. That's from Newsweek. Oh, speaking of strikes in Pakistan, 47 minutes ago, BBC News reported another U.S. strike has killed 15 in Pakistan. In a suspected U.S. missile strike in Pakistan, they said the attack hit a house in the village of Mir Ali in North Waziristan, bordering Afghanistan. Reuters and Reuters UK have suspected U.S. missiles kill up to 20 in Pakistan. Oh, and then one of them even says Al-Qaeda militant said killed in U.S. strike in Pakistan. Ooh, maybe they killed the number two Al-Qaeda guy for the 15th time. And finally, at the top of Google News right now, McCain says Obama's economic policies swing far left. And that's from Youngstown, Ohio, and the Associated Press. Back to MediaMonarchy.com to one of the stranger developments in the last week. My initial response to this, and when I mentioned it to other people, is she's out of her fucking mind. I believe it was off the reservation. One of my bosses at work said, Sarah Palin supports a new investigation into 9/11. You're gonna need it. John McCain's presidential running mate, Sarah Palin, much to the bewilderment of the 9/11 truth community, seemingly expressed support for a new investigation into the terrorist attacks during a rally in Ohio last week. Asked by We Are Change Ohio, quote, "Do you support the family members and first responders who are calling for a new 9/11 investigation?" Palin responded, "I do. I do because I think that helps us get to the point of never again, and if anything that we could do could still complete that reminder out there." Palin was aware of the context because she then asked the cameraman if he had been affected by 9/11. Of course, one would have to be incredibly naive to think that Palin, at best a befuddled Republican poster child and at worst another establishment neocon, would follow through on her support and back a new 9/11 investigation should John McCain snatch victory from the jaws of defeat and take the White House. Some of the interesting things to note further down in that article, of course, is that her running mate, John McCain, wrote the foreword to the Popular Mechanics Debunking 9/11 Myths book. There's also really amusing video of him knowingly posing with 9/11 truthers in front of a big Investigate 9/11 banner. Not sure what to make of that, my friends. I know I clicked into the 33rd Parallel News with Matt Kazee the other day and listened to him phone jamming some radio douchebag somewhere, Rodney Humphreys. Better known as Rodney Chumphreys, just busted him again and again and again, getting on the phone asking about Sarah Palin and 9/11, and the guy wigs out and wants to get off the air and quit. That's one of the things I do wish I had more time. I don't have time to sit around on hold to try and get on talk shows, but God, it's so much fun to get in on some right-wing, left-wing, gatekeeper bullshit mainstream media radio show and ask them tough questions they don't want to deal with because it breaks down the left-right phony-ass paradigm. The Washington Times has an article, and more of an op-ed, "Scare Tactics Mark Final Election Days." In these last desperate days of the 2008 presidential campaign, we must suffer visions of divas, plumbers, skinheads, and Karl Marx dancing before our disbelieving eyes. Karl Marx? Has it come to that arcane scare tactic, even though it's completely viable, and we'll get into that in a minute? We've been promised that this election would be different. It would be about character, experience, qualifications, and maybe even issues such as our tanking economy. But in this final week, the telebabble is going to be about stupid stuff, speculative stuff, and scary stuff. The brilliant Richard C. Cook, writing up on globalresearch.ca, "War or Peace? The World After the 2008 U.S. Presidential Election." World war or world peace is the blunt choice that will face either Obama or McCain when one of them is elected President of the United States on Tuesday, November 4th, 2008. For a major eruption of violence to be averted, the new president must deal positively with the reappearance of Russia on the world stage, the emergence of China as an economic force, and the aspirations of all the nations on Earth for a fucking decent and secure way of life. Making matters much more dangerous are the ongoing financial crisis, along with what appears to be the start of a worldwide economic recession as of yet undetermined depth and duration. It is Europe, not the U.S., from which proposals are emerging for a transformative approach to the most compelling issues. But will it be enough? And again, coming from Europe, you have people like Sarkozy and Brown calling for new financial world order. This article from Richard C. Cook, "War or Peace," is epic. It's dozens of pages long. So if we scroll down to the very last paragraph, and it says, "Those with eyes to see knew this present crisis was looming long ago. That vision now has spread to more people. What is increasingly clear is that positive change, as opposed to the change that is just adrift to disaster, will only happen when people who love freedom demand it, work for it, and sacrifice for it. Will the next president of the United States facilitate such change or stand in its way?" I can't figure out if he's giving some sort of none too thinly veiled nudge and nod to Obama.
but I don't have time to think about that right now. We're going to move to threat level up on wire.com. More on vote fraud from my home state of West Virginia. West Virginia gives ES&S an award while their machines malfunction. A day after West Virginia Secretary of State Betty Ireland held a press conference to address vote-switching problems with touchscreen voting machines made by Election Systems and Software, which I incorrectly named on a previous episode, ES&S, Election Systems and Software. Of course, I reminded you, if you're in Portland here, to look at the bottom of your safe ballot and see at the bottom it says Election Systems and Software, Scantron. But I digress. Betty Ireland presented an award of merit to an ES&S vice president who had abruptly and mysteriously left the company in May after 11 years of service, according to the Charleston Gazette. Now doing seemingly timely, important investigative journalism, and it's nice to see coming out of Southern West Virginia. Gary Greenhall, an ES&S vice president of sales, helped the company win a $17 million contract to supply machines to West Virginia in 2005 and was the company's point person for dealing with election officials until he left ES&S. Last week, Betty Ireland, West Virginia's Secretary of State, gave him a medallion award from the National Association of Secretaries of State at a special ceremony. The award came the same week that voters in several West Virginia counties reported that ES&S's Ivotronic touchscreen machines were flipping their votes from Obama to McCain. Ireland addressed the problem by directing the 34 West Virginia counties that use the touchscreen machines to recalibrate them each morning during early voting and on election day. There are other videos and other angles to this story up on bradblog.com and more from Threat Level. There's a video, Recalibrated Machine in West Virginia Appears to Record Vote Inaccurately. I had bookmarked this, and by the time it posted it up, there were updates. The initial videos that came out had been edited, and it looked all mangled and that the machines were working properly. Fortunately, Jeff Waybright, who's running the elections in the ES&S in, I believe, Ripley and Putnam County in West Virginia, they then released the full videos, and fortunately, Threat Level and others, Brad Blog, updated it and said that no, ultimately it looks like the machines are doing okay. Out of the woods by no means, but at least not as bad as we initially thought. However, more from Threat Level, as a way to wrap that up at least, group warns election officials about Diebold voting machine quote-unquote flaw. Several election watchdog groups have sent an advisory to election officials warning them about a problem with Premier Election Solutions vote tabulating software that could cause the system to lose votes. Premier, formerly called Diebold Election Systems, disclosed the problem in August after officials in Butler County, Ohio, discovered that 150 votes were dropped from a memory card during the state's March primary. 10 other Ohio counties discovered their system had dropped votes as well when vote totals on the memory card were uploaded to a county server. The problem occurred when officials tried to upload multiple memory cards at once. All of the votes were recovered, but Ohio officials had to expend considerable time and energy to retrieve them and make sure all were accounted for. Another name change. Whack-a-mole will change our name, will disappear. We're Whack and Hut. No, we're the Geo Group. Oh, we're Laidlaw Transit. No, we're First Student. Oh, we're Blackwater USA. Oh, we're Blackwater Worldwide. Kentucky Fried Chicken becomes AMC, or rather KFC, and American Movie Classics becomes AMC, because as you shift from your actual passionate original mission, whether it's frying chicken like it's from Kentucky or showing uncut film classics, once you dilute it and you become sold out, you know, you got to change your name a little bit and get a little more general, because we're all aiming for the bottom in a race to the lowest common denominator. But I digress yet again. CBS4 in Denver reported that election watchdog groups have accused the Republican Secretary of State of illegally purging up to 30,000 voters from voter rolls.
Well, the last thing you want to hear when you show up to vote November 4th is, sorry, I can't find your name. Election watchdog groups accuse the Secretary of State of illegally purging the 30,000 voters from the polls. CBS 4's Sean Boyd live at the federal courthouse where a judge heard that case today, Sean.
Karen, those election watchdogs are asking the court to freeze any more voter purges and to reinstate those voters whose registrations they say were illegally canceled. But with the election just a week away, tonight the issue hangs in the balance.
I was really, really upset, especially being a first-time voter.
CSU student Alexandra Vitale still isn't sure how it happened. 1 month after registering to vote, she got a call from a voter rights group telling her she was among tens of thousands of voters who'd been purged from the rolls. And even her county clerk couldn't explain it.
And I said to them, you know, I'm not dead and I haven't moved, so why did this happen? And they said they didn't know.
And she's not alone, according to watchdog groups suing the Secretary of State.
If we move to my local provider of your favorite left phony gatekeepers, Air America, named, of course, after the covert drug running out of Vietnam. From 620kpoj.com, I see dead people voting. A Portland think tank says Oregon voter rolls include 6,000 dead people. Secretary of State Bill Bradbury says most are just inactive voters. The Cascade Policy Institute reported last week that state voter rolls included the names of 6,000 dead people. Secretary of State Bill Bradbury says not to worry, dead people can't sign a ballot, and forging a ballot is a Class C felony. Bradbury says election officials investigated the charges and found of the 6,000 names, over 4,900 were inactive registrants. A voter may be deemed inactive if they have moved and not updated their info or have not voted in 5 years. Inactive voters do not receive a ballot by mail. Bradbury says the remaining 111 active voters, a random sampling revealed about half of those were alive and kicking. So does that ultimately mean about 550 are actually dead and voting in Oregon? The dead have risen from their graves and are shuffling their way to vote for the Obamasiah. I suppose this leads us quite well into our next bizarre story, again on vote fraud. However, CNN's Susan Rosgen reported that the Wisconsin Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, H-O-L-L-E-N, is fighting to have voter registrations purged from the rolls if their registration information does not match with other government databases. Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen's case was dismissed last week, but he plans to file an appeal because he says that voter fraud is about as likely as alien abduction.
You already registered?
The line of early voters stretches down the hallway outside the county clerk's office in Madison. But is anybody trying to vote who's not supposed to? The Wisconsin Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, is convinced there are.
Some people are registered who are fictitious or are voting at fictitious addresses.
Fill in your name and address.
Van Hollen mentioned three cases filed in the last month that allege violation of voter registration laws. He hinted there were others, but wouldn't give details. Still, he's trying to force the state elections board to check and recheck every voter's ID. If they don't, Van Hollen insists that Wisconsin is ripe for massive voter fraud. Critics don't buy it.
I compare the possibility of massive vote fraud in Wisconsin to the same likelihood as alien abduction. This is a statute book.
Lester Pines is the attorney for the Wisconsin Election Board. He showed us the election law that says the current ID checks are sufficient, and this week a judge agreed. The attorney general lost a lawsuit against the election board, but he says he will appeal. Why is there such a fight? Some say the attorney general is playing party politics to favor the Republicans.
Isn't it true that there was a discussion in your office with lawyers for the GOP a week before you filed this lawsuit?
I understand that to be true.
Did they ask you to file this lawsuit?
No, they may have asked lawyers in my office to file the lawsuit.
It turns out the state attorney general is also the state honorary co-chairman of Senator McCain's election campaign.
I have no doubt in my mind that there are going to be people out there who are going to say, boy, that looks a little bit fishy, and they do. That's the reason why you're here, I believe.
Anybody else need to register?
A county clerk responsible for registering voters says no matter who wins, the voting process will be fair and accurate.
Sometimes a voter will fill out a registration form
farm, and they have misspelled the name of their street. That's the closest thing we've come to.
So you don't have massive voter fraud here?
No.
Are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
But the fight isn't over. The Wisconsin Republican Party has joined the Attorney General in demanding tougher voter registration.
Are you sure? Are you sure? Returning to threat level, five top national security research challenges for the next president. This is written as a special on threat level by a guy named Drew Conway, a doctoral candidate at NYU He's studying international conflict and terrorism. He blogs at Zero Intelligence Agents up on the NYU.edu website. This is his first post up on Wire.com. While everybody else is focused on next week's presidential election, I took some time to consider what scientific research might have the most impact on national security over the next 4 years, no matter who's in the White House. I truncated it down and gave you the pertinent links to the five top national security research challenges, and these are heady and difficult topics. Number one, quantum cryptography. Number two, applications for genetic algorithms in battlefield operations. Number three, multi-layered network dynamics, featuring our good friends at DARPA. Number four, defining the Defense Department's and intelligence community's presence in cyberspace. And number five, hardening of biometric data collection and analysis. So, number five says we need more biometric face scan databases. Number four says that, of course, like Rumsfeld's Pentagon Information Operations Roadmap, says that we need to treat the internet like it was an enemy weapons system. Number three, multi-layered network dynamics, featuring our friends at DARPA, the Defense Applied Research something or other. Number two, applications for genetic algorithms in battlefield operations. And the first one was quantum cryptography, which, if we link to BBC News in their article, Unbreakable Encryption Unveiled, also notes that the U.S. is far behind in quantum cryptography. So again, those are heady topics, but the links are there for you to do the research yourself. An interesting one from the timesonline.co.uk, the 10 worst presidents to have held office. They rank them all in order, I believe in order, and they're all there. It was a little difficultly laid out, but it includes folks like, of course, George Bush and Martin Van Buren and William Henry Harrison, but come on, he died in 30 days. What do you want? On a better note, an interview originally coming from the Suicide Girls website, and fortunately pointed out by 911blogger.com, I just gave one little quick excerpt from a blistering interview with actor James Cromwell, who, of course, among many, many, many other roles, currently is portraying Poppy Bush in Oliver Stone's New W. In this interview, James Cromwell pretty much sounds like he knows exactly what the fuck is going on, basically stopping short of coming out on 9/11. So here's one quote from James Cromwell in his interview with Suicide Girls. Put Cheney in jail. That would be more appropriate. I do believe that if that woman wins in Vermont, the Attorney General, she will. Bugliosi's book is the blueprint for how. I believe that what happened on 9/11 was a crime against the American people and should have been pursued by law enforcement in a rational way. Then we would have Osama bin Laden. If, in fact, Osama bin Laden is responsible, we'd have him behind bars. It was used as an excuse for a coup. The second in my lifetime, the first one being at the death of JFK. This is the second coup, the destruction of American democracy. We need the men who have perpetrated this coup behind bars where they belong as a lesson to the other despots that they cannot behave this way. And that's just one of the many amazingly politically astute and cutting and awake comments from actor James Cromwell. And again, that's posted up on 911blogger.com. Around election time, seemingly for the last many, many years, we, of course, look at all the funny stories about, how funny it is that all of our candidates are all fucking related. Oh, it's so funny. They're all related elites. Obama related to Cheney, related to the Queen of fucking England, Illuminati bloodlines, all of them. So, my man Aaron Dykes over on truthnews.us reminds us of something CBS News ran last October in 2007, a TV report about the president's ancestry making quaint discussion at his dynastic family's apparent deep roots in the ruling class. And again, that video is there, and it's all there, and it shows Kerry, Cheney, Obama, Bush, Brad Pitt, Vlad the Impaler. It doesn't matter. But we're going to wrap up this first major posting on the presidential selection 08 victory investigations. This, my friends, is what it looks like with the video, but right now, this is what it sounds like when a candidate tells the truth.
On 9/11, three skyscrapers were felled by two planes. World Trade Center 7, the Patriot Act, the financial crash, the bailout, all share characteristics of controlled demolitions, criminal fraud, and treason. We the people need the courage to seek and speak the truth. We need to investigate the big lies. We need to arrest, impeach the terrorists. We need to defend our Constitution, our rights, our lives. I'm Carol Brier, Green Party candidate for Congress, and I approve this message. Vote Green for truth, peace, and justice.
Carol Brier, we covered her longer campaign video a couple weeks ago. That's just a little 30-second spot. So, if you live in California's 14th Congressional District, you have an opportunity that is tragically unavailable to most other Americans. You can vote for a congressional candidate who has the courage and the knowledge to say the things that Democrats would say if they really represented change or hope or even audacity. And speaking of audacity, we move now to our second big posting on the presidential selection 08, Obama fraud, fascism, plots, and threats. First, from the Associated Press, skinhead plot to kill Obama uncovered.
These skinheads in Tennessee, the ATF breaking up a purported assassination, not just aimed at you, but aimed at African Americans. What's your reaction to that?
You know, look, I think what's been striking in this campaign is the degree to which these kinds of hate groups have been completely marginalized. That's not who America is. That's not what our future is. Yeah, well, our future is what's reflected in this rally here today.
Does it worry you about your own safety?
Yeah, I got the best folks in the world, Secret Service.
And right. Senator, I hope you're coming back to Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Before Barack Obama, it's claimed the skinheads planned a sickening hate campaign, which started with killing 88 other black people. They then intended to attack another 14 before going for their biggest target. Police believe Obama was lined up to be their final act. Federal agents discovered the plan after they stopped the attempted robbery of a gun store in Tennessee. Obama's locked in a battle with Republican John McCain in the race for the White House, and in just over a week, we'll find out which one of them will become the next leader of the free world.
The prospect of a black president has America's bastions of hate in an uproar.
White power! White power!
Leaders, including the wizard of the Imperial Clan of America, Ron Edwards, have long warned the white race is under attack and must be defended.
We can be very violent, and we can be very deceptive, and we will do whatever we have to do to survive.
Federal authorities say online websites have featured ugly calls to target Senator Barack Obama. And twice now since August, two sets of self-proclaimed neo-Nazi skinheads have been caught in what officials say were feeble but still troubling plots to assassinate Obama.
If Obama's elected president, these people see the world as they've known it to end, and the beginning of what they believe will be a kind of marginalized, mixed up, country that's not controlled by white people.
In the most recent case, federal agents say these two men, Daniel Cowart and Paul Schlusselman, planned to go on a killing spree against more than 100 African Americans. And then, they told the Secret Service, go out in a blaze of glory, dress in white tuxedos and top hats during the assassination attempt against Obama.
feeble and disturbing indeed. Many things to note in there. Of course, America isn't run by white guys anyway. It's run by ruling elite oligarchs. Feeble and disturbing kind of describes, I think, the whole campaign season. Nonetheless, again, from the Associated Press, two white supremacists allegedly plotted to go on a national killing spree, shooting and decapitating black people and ultimately targeting Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama. In all, the two men whom officials described as neo-Nazi skinheads planned to kill 88 people, 14 by beheading, according to documents unsealed in U.S. District Court in Jackson, Tennessee. The numbers 88 and 14 are symbolic in the white supremacist community. Another ridiculous plan that's, as you know, in the Fed's own words, much like these busted ops, it's more aspirational than operational. These guys never would have been able to pull off something like this anyway. Yep, beheading people, because that you can do that really quickly. It's or something like trying to bust into Fort Dix Army Base and shoot a bunch of people, or mix a bunch of chemicals on a plane, the liquid bombing. Another bullshit plot, however, it does keep the assassination meme forefront in our minds, and it continues, of course, to play the race card, divide and conquer. And again, it's not the first time we've had busted moron douchebags supposedly, allegedly plotting to assassinate Obama. An interesting update from the plot from August. Those other dumbass racists, whatever they are, we discover that a Rove appointee called off the FBI investigation into the August Obama murder plot. That's coming from Alex Constantine. And it goes back to, or no, I'm sorry. This is August, or rather September 7th, 2008. That, of course, three men in Denver planned to assassinate U.S. Senator Barack Obama during the DNC in Denver by sneaking into one of his events and shooting him with a gun hidden inside a camera. But, of course, a Rove appointee. I'm scanning for the guy's name. Oh. The FBI didn't want to pursue the charges because the investigation was called off by Attorney General Troy Eid, an appointee of Karl Rove. That's Troy E-I-D. Rove appointee called off FBI investigation into the August Obama murder plot. And again, you just heard three clips from different news sources. The last one there was from ABC News and Bob Ross talking in the longer clip to Stephen Edwards of Muhlenberg County, Kentucky, who's considered the leader of the Supreme White Alliance. Edwards said that the Supreme White Alliance is a social club that doesn't hate. Brian Ross found that Edwards and his group have different views in private. And that was from ABC's Nightline on October 29th. So, Supreme White Alliance is a social club that doesn't hate. It's like, you know, the Masons aren't a secret society. They're a society with secrets. CanadaFreePress.com fortunately reminding us and pointing out that Biden again mentioning the New World Order, as he is apt to do, saying, quote, "This is the most important election in the public's life. They're looking at these races very closely. I think this is going to be much closer than everyone thinks. Second, with regard to the Democratic Party, this is a new Democratic Party, not the party of the 70s and 80s. This is a party that has adjusted to the realities of a new world order. I think there's going to be a collaborative effort to make the 21st century an American century." Now, I don't believe that Senator Joseph Biden signed the think tank paper Rebuilding America's Defenses from the PNAC Boys Project for a New American Century, but he sure seems to echo their sentiments. "I think there's going to be a collaborative effort to make the 21st century an American century." Now, that may be the North American century, but that remains to be seen. If we return to threat level, an interesting one, Obama's secret weapons, internet, databases, and psychology, the Obama campaign has been building, tweaking, and tinkering with its technology and organizational infrastructure since it kicked off in February 07, and today has the most sophisticated organizing apparatus of any presidential campaign in history. Previous political campaigns have tapped the internet in innovative ways. Howard Dean's 2004 presidential run and Ron Paul's bid for this year's Republican nomination, to name two. But Obama is the first to successfully integrate technology with a revamped model of political organization that stresses volunteer participation and feedback on a massive scale, erecting a vast, intricate machine set to fuel an unprecedented get-out-the-vote drive in the final days before Tuesday's selection. And there's a nice photo of a good little Obamazoid. And this is exactly what Webster Tarpley is talking about in his two new books, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, and Obama, The Postmodern Coup. This is a classic foundation-funded, phony, grassroots fascist uprising. We move to McClatchy, Obama's infomercial focused on the economy. Of course, Obama ran his little infomercial the other night. Codes, keys, and triggers. Barack Obama will focus on the economy and how his tax plan would help the middle class in a half-hour political infomercial Wednesday night. The program, which ran on television networks on the 79th anniversary of the stock market crash of 1929, quote, will share the specifics of Obama's plans to turn the economy around and get the country back on track, and other vague, change-oriented platitudes, said by campaign spokesman Bill Burton. We want to make sure every voter heading into the voting booth knows exactly what Obama would do to bring about fundamental change as president. One of the things he would probably do is pointed out in a new interview that's been uncovered, a 2001 interview with Obama on Chicago Public Radio, and this is the supposed bombshell redistribution of wealth audio, where they say he wants to radically reinterpret the Constitution to redistribute wealth. And the video, with lots of subtitles for you, I'm not going to play the clip this time. It talks about the radical underneath the rhetoric, supposedly. Again, they're both banker boys. And let's get Kurt Nimmo to explain that a little more with an article from InfoWars. Obama is the quote-unquote Marxist front man for the banksters.
You may recognize this famous quote, from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. That's from Karl Marx. How is Senator Obama not being a Marxist if he intends to spread the wealth around?
Are you joking? Is this a joke?
No.
Or is that a real question?
That's a question.
He is not spreading the wealth around. He's talking about giving the middle class an opportunity to get back the tax breaks they used to have. What has happened? Just this year, people making $1.4 million average, the top 1%, good, decent American people, are going to get a new $87 billion tax cut. A new one on top of last year. We think the people should be getting that tax break and not continue to redistribute the wealth up. We think middle class taxpayers should get a tax break. That's what we think. It's a ridiculous comparison, with all due respect.
Now, you recently said, mark my words, it'll not be 6 months before the world tests Barack Obama. But what worries many people is your caveat, asking them to stand with him because it's not going to be apparent initially that he's right. Are you forewarning Americans that nothing will be done and that America's days as the world's leading power are over?
No, I'm not at all. I don't know who's writing your questions, but let me make it clear to you. The fact of the matter is that everyone has acknowledged from Colin Powell on that the next president of the United States is going to be tested, whether it's John McCain and or it's Barack Obama. The reason is our weakened position in the world. We're stretched thin throughout the world. Our economy's in free fall right now, and they're going to be tested. Every president is tested. And the point I was making is Barack Obama is much much better prepared to handle whatever crisis it's going to be than John McCain, because John was wrong in Iraq saying we'd be greeted as liberators, we'd be out of there, wrong in Afghanistan saying we've already succeeded, wrong in North Korea and saying the president shouldn't negotiate. Barack Obama's been right, John McCain's been wrong. That was my point. Barack Obama is more ready than John McCain.
Getting back to the spreading the wealth question, what do you say to the people who are concerned that Barack Obama will want to turn America into a socialist country much like Sweden?
I don't know anybody who thinks that except the far right wing of the Republican Party.
Okay, Senator Biden, thank you.
So, is Obama a Marxist, as was asked in a video, in an interview that we're going to hear from? And that's the meme. We, of course, heard it mentioned a little bit ago in that Washington Times op-ed. Is Obama a Marxist? Will he redistribute the wealth to the middle class? This is the question a WFTV anchor posed to Joe Biden. It was, of course, an absurd question, considering Obama is the bankster candidate of choice. Of course, getting most of his funds from Goldman Sachs. Banksters do not redistribute wealth. They don't redistribute the wealth downward. That is, they direct it upward, that is, into their own coffers. In fact, the word is not even accurate. It's not redistribution, it's theft. The banksters are grand theft larcenous on a monumental scale. Karl Marx's ideology was a historical ruse, a stratagem for the ruling elite. Of course, you know, basically pushed and funded Engels and Marx, pushed the communist agenda. Pressure from above, pressure from below. Marx was related to the Rothschild family, which we'll get into more. Nathan Mayer Rothschild married Hannah Barrett Cohen, daughter of Levi Barrett Cohen and wife of Lydia Dienmanschleifer, and parental granddaughter of Barrett Cohen and wife, whose other son, Solomon David Barrett Cohen, married Sarah Brands, the great-grandparents of Karl Marx. Nathan Rothschild had given Marx two checks for several thousand pounds to finance the cause of socialism. The checks were put on display in the British Museum after Lord Lionel Walter Rothschild, a trustee, had willed his museum and library to them. This argued by David Rivera in the book Final Warning, A History of the New World Order. But even if Rothschild had nothing to do with his relative Karl Marx, the political philosophy of Marxism was custom-built for the banksters. No wealth will be spread to the beleaguered middle class as advertised. No tax cuts will be forthcoming. After Obama is anointed, the engineered economic crisis will intensify, and Obama, the sock puppet for the banksters and Wall Street, will demand wholesale sacrifice on part of us plebs. His Council on Foreign Relations connected wife and vice president said as much earlier in the year. Obama, the foundation-financed wunderkind shepherded by the advocate of globalist primacy, Zbigniew Brzezinski, indeed has nothing but contempt for the American people, and that is why he was groomed to lead, or rather take orders. ThinkProgress.org is apoplectic over Representative Steve King, a Republican from Iowa, who says that Obama will make the U.S. a totalitarian dictatorship. So last Saturday, Representative Steve King gave little noticed remarks at Sioux City's West High School during an appearance by Governor Sarah Palin. King went beyond the traditional right-wing talking points, which branded Obama a Marxist who adheres to socialism, and said that he would turn the United States into a totalitarian dictatorship. From a report by the Iowa Independent, quote, King, known for provocative partisan remarks, suggested Obama actually could be classified as even more extreme than a socialist. King also said his party is the only one with a legitimate claim on representing freedom as Americans know it. When you take a lurch to the left, you end up in a totalitarian dictatorship. There is no freedom to the left. It's always to our side of the aisle. Jumping to Philly, Philadelphia Daily News, a federal judge throws out Philip J. Berg's suit against Barack Obama. A federal judge in Philadelphia on October 24th threw out a complaint by a Montgomery County lawyer who claimed that Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama was not qualified to be president and that his name should be removed from the November 4th ballot. Philip J. Berg alleged in a complaint filed in federal district court on August 24th against Obama, the DNC, and the FEC that Obama was born in Mombasa, Kenya. Berg claimed that the Democratic presidential standard bearer is not even an American citizen, but a citizen of Indonesia and therefore ineligible to be president. The follow-up to this from ObamaCrimes.com. This is the latest I have. Philip J. Berg arrived at the United States Supreme Court yesterday in D.C. at 3:15 in the afternoon to file an injunction to stay presidential election pending writ of certiorari regarding Obama, who is not qualified to be president of the United States. And you can download the press release PDF, Berg filing injunction to stay presidential election. And I would say that the window for October surprise is quickly closing, my friends. If we wondered if any of the more amazing questions about Obama, or McCain's citizenship for that matter, they probably should have come out by now. My sneaking suspicion is that it's going to really come out and come out big one way or the other. However, if we wait until Obama is in office and it's discovered, oh, whoops, they were faked. Oh, he's not really a citizen. We will rush headlong, my friends, into changing the Constitution, thereby opening the door for our good friend, Nazi Schwarzenegger. The New York Times reports that Obama's building his White House team, and of course I add all by himself, I bet. Really? He's not getting any help from Brzezinski and the Trilateral Commission and Goldman Sachs and his skull and bones financial advisor, Alston Goolsbee. But anyway, with the economy in tatters at home and two wars still raging abroad, Senator Obama's team is preparing for a fast start should he win the election to what could be the most challenging and volatile transition between presidents in 75 years. Mr. Obama's advisors are sifting resumes, compiling policy options, and discussing where to hold his first news conference as president-elect. I'm sure it'll be at some massive, massive stadium that Obama likes with some kind of Illuminati arches or pillars or rising sun sacred symbology. Democrats say Mr. Obama hopes to name key members of his White House economic and security team soon after the election. His transition chief has even drafted a sample inaugural address. Presidential nominees typically start prepping for transitions before the election, but Mr. Obama's plans appear more extensive than in the past and more advanced than those of McCain, his Republican opponent. Mr. McCain has also assigned confidants to prepare for a transition, but instructed them to limit their activities as he tries to rescue his floundering campaign. An interesting return to dailydoseofterror.blogspot.com with a note written from the writer and webmaster, Greg Nixon. Obama fascism? ? This past Friday, I was at the University of Vermont for an anti-war rally where I held a giant sign reading, "Arrest Obama." The visceral vitriol among the students was omnipresent. That I had criticized Obama, the Messiah, from the left was an unpardonable offense. I had info with Obama's pro-war voting record and outlining that he supports George Bush on the global war on terror, but that didn't matter. He was a candidate for change. TV commercial said so. No discussion, that's final. What I came away with that afternoon was a palpable fear of a blind, unthinking mass of Obama supporters. How is this any fucking different than the Bush flag wavers? As Webster Tarpley has argued, historically, fascism did not emerge from a top-down hierarchy. It arose from the left. I tried to argue with the students that elections were staged and Obama was a robot assembled in Brzezinski's laboratory to read PR scripts. Not literally, of course. The students cannot fathom that the alleged opposition was a wing of the same bird. This is not some academic exercise. My friend was arrested here in my city after asking questions during a heated exchange to an Obama political table and faces jail time. Could an Obama presidency deliver fascism here in the United States? When the market collapses and people have no jobs and are hungry, will the mobs be ready to organize? I'm just raising questions to be asked during some strange and scary times. Stay tuned, says Greg Nixon at Daily Dose of Terror. Finally, on this posting, Selection 08, Obama fraud, fascism, plots, and plans, from the Washington Post. Military prepares for threats during presidential transition. The U.S. military, bracing for the first wartime presidential transition in 40 years, is preparing for potential crises during the vulnerable handover period, including possible attacks by al-Qaeda and destabilizing developments in Iraq or Afghanistan. I think the enemy could well take advantage of the transfer of power in Washington, said the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, who launched preparation for the transition months ago and who will brief the president-elect, the defense secretary nominee, and other incoming officials on crisis management and how to run the military. Officials are working, quote, to make sure we are postured for the right way around the world militarily, that our intel is focused on the issue, and in day-to-day ops, the military is making sure it does not happen, Mullen said in an interview. If it does happen, we need to be in a position to respond before and after the inauguration. Last week, of course, we went over all the inaugural terror event threatiganda coming from war criminals like Colin Powell and Madeleine Albright. There's a nice little listing on Michael Mullen over on historycommons.org, where you can read about some of the lies in the lead up to the war and more and more. Glancing again at Google News right now on this Friday morning, Halloween 2008, it's going to get nasty in final days before election. That's coming from CNN with just days to go before Election Day. Obama is warning his supporters that things are going to get unpleasant fast and that the race will come down to every last vote. As we've done before, a nice way to put a lot of these stooges and puppets into perspective is to get a more intelligent and experienced and nuanced and constitutional voice. And the way we do that is by going to our man Ron Paul, where he notes, of course, that Obama won't pull troops out of Iraq. 2 days after the election, top conservative leaders are meeting to discuss the best way to revive the Republican Party. Do they expect John McCain to lose? If so, who will be the new face of the GOP?
Well, a lot of them are running for office right now. You'd be surprised. There are some states, there's 20 and 30 individuals up running, and they did it spontaneously due to the enthusiasm built in the campaign. New Hampshire and Minnesota and different places, there's a lot of candidates. We can't even keep up with them, just as we couldn't keep up with how we were raising the money in the primary. There's a lot of spontaneous energy because the message is so great. The message of individual liberty really attracted the young people. It's interesting that a lot of young people that Obama have go back and forth. They support him, but they like me. And yet our message is significantly different. But our message is very attractive to young people. They like the idea of self-reliance and individual liberty. They like to get out of these wars. They love the idea of talking about monetary policy, which neither McCain or Obama will dare talk about. Why do we have a Federal Reserve? And now that we have this financial crisis going on, the young people are really excited. Well, this is what we've been talking about not only for the past 2 years, for about many more years. So it's very appropriate to talk about this financial calamity, how it's related to this $1 trillion a year expenditure that we spend on our foreign policy, and how it's bringing us to our knees, and how we've more or less capitulated to Osama bin Laden's idea of getting us over there, bogging us down overseas in a war like they did to the Soviets, bankrupting this country. So we have fallen into a terrible trap. And right now, we're expanding it. And unfortunately, the two major candidates aren't even talking about Syria and Pakistan and the things that are important, because they essentially both agree with that viewpoint. They both say send more troops to Afghanistan. And quite frankly, I am not expecting the troops, regardless of whether Obama wins, that they'll be home in 16 months. And that is just pure political talk. Both candidates support the same foreign policy, same monetary policy. Neither one talks about balancing the budget. So the young people want to hear something different. They love the message of individual liberty. They love the idea of defending the Constitution, you know, that old-fashioned idea. And that's what has energized our campaign. Actually, it's given me a lot of energy as well.
Former presidential candidate, current Republican congressman and political phenom, Dr. Ron Paul, thank you so much for joining us tonight, sir.
Thank you.
It's the sequel to Halloween, Halloween 2, another classic from the Misfits, and we're halfway through this epic, special, three-hour episode of Media Monarchy. It's Halloween 2008, and it's episode 98 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. Coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, revereradionetwork.com, KBFR in Boulder, and 87.9 Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta. Dozens of potential terrorists in U.S. under watch, Chertoff says. This from the Associated Press, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Son of the Devil, Chertoff, in Russian, loosely translates to Son of the Devil, says the federal government is monitoring dozens of potential terrorists in the U.S. I wonder if they're white Al-Qaeda. Chertoff tells the Record of Bergen County Record, the government has quietly blocked dozens of potential terrorists from entering the country in recent years. Chertoff says he can't say for sure whether the people knew or whether the people kept out would have carried out a plot. The New Jersey native says America is still a terrorist target. Chertoff says there is a risk that some would see opportunity during the transition between administrations. Chertoff says he doesn't want to stay with Homeland Security after a new president is in office, and the lawyer says he doesn't have a job waiting, which we know is probably bullshit. He'll go to the private sector, to the private military-industrial complex, and give lots of contracts for whoever he works for to the DOD and the military-industrial complex in the Iron Triangle Trilateralist Military Pentagon Money Bullshit. An interesting one caught my eye. From the West Virginia Department of Education, 9/11 first responders to visit West Virginia school. This, of course, coming from 911blogger.com to my attention. But the text, again, is from the West Virginia Department of Education press release for you. John Feel, president, founding president of the Feel Good Foundation, F-E-A-L Good Foundation, feelgoodfoundation.com, and a demolition expert who worked at Ground Zero following 9/11 will bring his message to Upshur County students and residents, or did, rather, on last Friday, October 24th. Feel and up to seven other first responders will meet with students at the Buchanan Upshur High School and met with the community later in the day. Feel, like 70% of 9/11 workers, suffers from post-9/11 illnesses. One of his feet had to be amputated after being crushed by an 8-ton steel beam. He also suffers from a respiratory syndrome called World Trade Center cough and post-traumatic stress disorder. World Trade Center cough, of course, from the toxic dust that Christy Todd Whitman of the EPA said it was okay to breathe because we need to open Wall Street. Feel agreed to visit West Virginia after some Buchanan Upshur High School students contacted him via email after watching a documentary in health educator Maytal Poling's class. The documentary, Save the Brave, covered on Media Monarchy back in September, along with Fabled Enemies and The Elephant in the Room, three new 9/11 documentaries. Save the Brave chronicles the daily struggles of 9/11 Ground Zero workers in the 7 years since the attacks. Greg Quibel, one of the men in the feature, died of his injuries the day before the film's premiere in New York. You have no idea how excited they were when Feel replied. Me too, Poling said, the teacher. It's hard to imagine that these kids were only first and second graders on 9/11, but thanks to Feel's efforts, our students are starting to have a better understanding of the profound effects of that day. John Feel said he's, quote, humbled and honored to meet such amazing Americans. They're a reflection of the teacher who has taught them well. Your resolve and testament is what makes great future leaders of this country. We look forward to coming to the great state of West Virginia to share our stories and tell the thousands that need our help. Tell of the thousands that need all our help. The Feel Good Foundation's primary mission, according to his website, is to, quote, spread awareness and educate the public about the catastrophic health effects on 9/11 first responders, as well as to provide assistance to relieve these great heroes of the financial burdens placed on them over the last 5 years. The foundation also works to create a network of advocacy on 9/11 healthcare issues. If we shift back into a little more geopolitics, and it's always important to note again that the bankster puppets that are going to get your vote on Tuesday, they both want more war, more troops to Afghanistan, more drone ops on Pakistan, and more of this CIA-led strikes inside Syria. This coming from McClatchy News. A CIA-led raid on a compound in eastern Syria killed an al-Qaeda in Iraq commander. So it's al-Qaeda in Iraq. Apparently that's now a new designation. I guess it's not new. I just hadn't thought about it. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they have to... Okay, so we've got that delineation now. A CIA-led raid on a compound in eastern Syria killed an al-Qaeda and Iraq commander who oversaw the smuggling into Iraq of foreign fighters whose attacks claimed thousands of Iraqi and American lives, three U.S. officials said Monday. The body of Badran Turki Hishan al-Mizdi, an Iraqi national who used the nom de guerre, or war name from the French, Abu Ghadia, G-H-A-D-I-Y-A, he was flown out of Syria on a U.S. helicopter at the end of the op Sunday by CIA paramilitary officers and special forces. It was a successful operation, a second U.S. official told McClatchy. The bottom line, this was a significant blow to the foreign fighter pipeline between Syria and Iraq. A senior U.S. military officer said the raid was launched after human and technical intelligence confirmed that al-Mazdi was present at the compound close to Syria's border with Iraq. Quote, the situation finally presented itself. The three U.S. officials, who all spoke on the condition of anonymity because the operation was classified, declined to reveal other details of the raid. As well, a CIA spokesman declined to comment, as they usually do. An update from Kurt Nimmo. CIA-led attack against Syria, related to security pact in Iraq that we've mentioned, the supposed 2011 pact that thousands of Iraqis are protesting. It should probably come as no surprise the CIA led the recent attack on Syria that allegedly killed an al-Qaeda commander who supposedly oversaw the smuggling into Iraq of foreign fighters whose attacks claimed thousands of lives, as according to what we just read from McClatchy. They all spoke on condition of anonymity. It's all classified. Kurt Nimmo again. The CIA has a long and sordid history of violating the national sovereignty of nations, beginning in 1948 when the agency's covert action wing was created by Wall Street lawyer Frank Wisner, W-I-S-N-E-R, Frank Wisner, OSS, Allen Dulles, CIA, Wall Street lawyers, gangsters. According to its charter, the Covert Action Wing, also called the Office of Policy Coordination, was responsible for, quote, propaganda, economic warfare, preventative direct action, including sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition, and evacuation procedures, subversion against hostile states, including assistance to underground resistance groups. And for more on that, you can click a link and read Steve Kanga's timeline of CIA atrocities. There is also a clip up with our man from Ohio, Dennis Kucinich, who says that we must question the timing of this CIA-led attack in Syria. So there's a CNN video, we must question the timing. Congressman Kucinich slams attack in Syria. Coming back to my own police state of Oregon, from the Associated Press, DMV to use facial recognition software in Oregon. They already are. I got a license a year ago. It's a digital photo. It's in the database. Now they're telling you about the database. They've already been taking your photo, and they're going to match it up biometrically. The new computers at the Oregon DMV never forget a face. The State Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division is installing the new computers to compare a new driver's license photo with an old license image to see if they match. The idea is to make it harder for criminals to get fake IDs. Oregon DMV spokesman David House said that it's one of the reasons drivers always get a temporary paper license when they get a renewal, as I did again. He said Digimark, D-I-G-I-M-A-R-C, the Beaverton, Oregon company behind the new technology, also needs time to review all the license application photos. Digimark is considered a leader in preventing electronic identity theft, counterfeiting, and piracy. But David House, DMV spokesman for Oregon, said that DMV workers will make the final decision after the computer makes its comparison. The software runs through millions of other photos in the system. If there's a question, trained DMV workers sit down with a photo and all the potential matches and decide whether or not to question the application. After the photo is confirmed, the laminated permanent driver's license with the new photo is sent by mail. Oregon lawmakers authorized the facial recognition system in 2005. I bet our good buddy Democrats voted for it. Thanks, Blumenauer. The system accounts for $3 in the $4.50 increase in the driver's license fee that went into effect in July. The new computers are scheduled to be installed throughout Oregon by the end of November. Not wasting any time. DMV offices getting the new equipment will be closed for a few hours while it's installed, and workers are trained how to use it. So they're going to be trained for a whole few hours. That should be fun. Going north to Alaska, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens found guilty of corruption. Ted Stevens convicted on 7 felony counts of corruption as his re-election looms largely, I would say.
But we're going to start this hour with some breaking news out of a federal courthouse in Washington. The jury that has been considering the counts against Republican Senator Ted Stevens now has apparently reached a verdict. NBC News correspondent Pete Williams has the latest. And Pete, is this coming up in just a couple of minutes now?
No, it's been announced in court, David. The jury has found Senator Ted Stevens, the U.S. Senate's longest-serving Republican, guilty on all seven counts of making false statements on his financial disclosure forms. Prosecutors had accused Stevens of failing to report that a close friend of his in Alaska did many thousands of dollars of gifts and favors totaling $250,000 to Stevens' house in Girdwood, Alaska. There was extensive renovation to that house. It was jacked up. Another story was added, a deck, a garage, decks all the way around, a metal staircase, and other furniture, stained glass windows, a barbecue. All of these things the government said Stevens failed to report for 2001 through 2006 on his financial disclosure forms.
Jacked up indeed. Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska was convicted of corruption on Monday, October 27th, a verdict that could endanger the Republicans' political future and help Democrats expand control of the Senate in the November 4th election. Stevens, 84, was convicted on all seven counts of lying on Senate disclosure forms by failing to report more than $250,000 in home renovations and other gifts from an oil executive. Stevens vowed to return to Alaska and resume campaigning for re-election against his Democratic challenger, Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich. Very interesting to note, as soon as I saw the name Begich and put it in the context of Alaska, yes, Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich is brother to Dr. Nick Begich, main lead researcher into the weather weapon known as HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, in Alaska. And they are both the son of Nick Begich Sr. He was, you know, a U.S. representative who died, he died in a plane crash with U.S. House Majority Leader Hale Boggs in 1972. And, that's right, it was on October 16th, 1972, right before an election, where he and Hale Boggs, who, if memory serves correct, quit the Warren Commission because he knew it was a bullshit cover-up. Wouldn't you know it, they got well-stoned back in 72. So, convicted felony criminal Senator Ted Stevens is running for re-election against Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich, brother to Dr. Nick Begich of HAARP Research. That would be a very good thing, I would think, for Mark Begich to kick Ted Tubes Stevens' ass. But Stevens said, "I will fight this unjust verdict with every ounce of energy I had," he said in a blistering statement issued after the verdict. "I ask that Alaskans and my Senate colleagues stand with me as I pursue my rights. I remain a candidate for the United States Senate." The loss of Stevens' seat could help Democrats control 60 seats in the 100-seat chamber, enough to overcome potential Republican roadblocks. The Senate could vote to expel a convicted felon with a two-thirds vote, but no action is expected before next week's election. Since 1789, the Senate has expelled only 15 members. And that whole video is posted up for you, as well as a full list of charges and verdicts on the seven counts of felony corruption in the Ted Stevens trial. That, thanks to McClatchyDC.com. The thing to tie this together, and the funny note from Threat Level, is that Senator Ted Stevens found guilty of a series of crimes. Senator Ted Stevens, the Alaska powerhouse Republican senator, was convicted on seven counts of lying about thousands and thousands of dollars in renovation work, including new plumbing, done on his home by a private oil services company. Stevens' defense that he thought he'd paid for the series of tubes did not persuade the D.C. jury, which convicted him on all charges. Stevens faces up to 5 years behind a series of bars for each count, but he's not likely to serve time under sentencing guidelines. He also says he's not stepping down from Congress because he's up for re-election. For those who don't recall, Ted Stevens' tube mania largely started on Threat Level. with links for you. You can see an early roundup. Ted Stevens, of course, noted for babbling about the internet as being a series of tubes getting clogged up. So Threat Level had some fun talking about the series of tubes have now turned into a series of crimes, and that he's going to be facing a series of bars. Back to the police state and the impending presidential selection. This, again, from Danger Room. And it's more presidential threataganda. Pentagon panel says Joe Biden was right. We should prep for crisis. The McCain campaign pounced the other day when Joe Biden said that his running mate would be tested by an international crisis at the start of his White House tenure. But the chairman of a key Pentagon advisory panel is sounding a similar warning, telling the next administration to, quote, prepare for a likely first 270 days crisis. Veteran Pentagon consultant Michael Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, chairman of the Defense Business Board, told his fellow panelists that the new president's inner circle should, quote, set aside time in transition to identify the planning, gravitas, and interagency process necessary to respond to a likely first 270-day crisis. From Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs, to LBJ and Gulf of Tonkin, to Clinton and the first World Trade Center bombing, to Bush and the second World Trade Center bombing, too many presidents were ill-prepared for this. For months, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the service chiefs, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff have been preparing for the first wartime transfer of Pentagon political authority in four decades, notes Inside Defense, DefenseNewsStand.com, which first broke word of Bayer's presentation. In addition to identifying defense policy issues for an incoming to understand, the military is also on high operational alert.
Listen to Joe Biden talking about what electing Barack Obama will mean.
Mark my words, it will not be 6 months before the world tests Barack Obama. The world is looking. We're going to have an international crisis to test the mettle of this guy. I guarantee you it's going to happen.
It doesn't have to happen. Vote McCain.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
Never thought I'd play a McCain campaign commercial, but it's interesting to note the threataganda coming from both sides. We've talked many months ago before the cast of war criminals like McCain or Power or Albright started to talk about a crisis. Inaugural terror. We talked about it months ago. The incoming puppet gets an inaugural terror event, so the people run to the government in fear, saying, oh my God, protect us from fill in the blank. And they say, oh my God, we just happen to have a thousands of page act written ahead of time. Problem, reaction, solution. Staying on the Selection 08 tip, the fix is in. This from winterpatriot.blogspot.com, Banana Republic North. In the past few days, John McCain has stopped campaigning in states which were once seen as toss-ups. Barack Obama has started campaigning in states which were once seen as safe for McCain. Obama's picked up major endorsement and huge funding increases. McCain's campaign has been caught trying to pull off perhaps the most despicable political dirty trick since 9/11. Winter Patriot speaking of the Acorn debacle. McCain's been pandering to the ultra-rich, and according to the latest polls, support for Obama has been imploding. Going to Reuters and that aforementioned Zogby poll showing Obama supposedly slipping. Obama's lead over McCain has dropped from 12 points on Thursday to 10 points on Friday, 9 points on Saturday, and 5 on Sunday. That's a 7-point decrease in 3 days. How can that happen? Consider this. It's far easier to rig the polls than it is to rig the election. How? The pollsters talk to a small and carefully selected group of people. They can get whatever results they want just by tweaking the sample. And they do. All the time. You know, like calling landlines. Do you have a landline? I don't have a landline and haven't for many years. I never get a phone call. Never been called. Have you ever been called with a political poll question? Consider this, too. The election could never be stolen unless there were polls indicating it would be close. Then all they need is a last-minute gaffe or October surprise or Al CIA to videotape, and the pundits can claim this was the difference in a race that was otherwise too close to call. can't happen here? Try again. It happened 4 years ago. It happened 8 years ago. It's happened in countless congressional elections in the past decade, and you can already smell it happening again. And so, as Election Day approaches, with all the appeal of a multi-train collision, the police are ready for action. The aforementioned article on thehill.com, Police Prepare for Unrest, that we covered last week. The police are ready for action, and so is the Army, noting the combat brigades here for crowd control under NORTHCOM. The police are ready for action, and so is the Army. Are you?
Tonight, about an Army combat brigade being trained to deal with civil disturbances in the United States. The Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 generally prohibits federal uniformed services from carrying out domestic law enforcement duties, except in cases expressly authorized by the Constitution or an act of Congress. Critics say the brigade's training goes against one of the founding principles of our country, separation of military and civilian government. Luis Giovanni has our report.
They've spent 30 months on the streets of Baghdad. Now the 1st Brigade Combat Team of the Army's 3rd Infantry Division is back in the USA. The Army Times reporting, quote, they may be called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control or to deal with potentially horrific scenarios, end quote. The question arises, why? And isn't that what the National Guard does?
Infantry Brigade is designed to engage an enemy with maximum effective force and destroy it. That's not the sort of thing anybody wants to see in the streets of the United States.
Almost 5,000 strong, the brigade is based at Fort Stewart, Georgia, under, quote, the primary purpose of this force is to provide help to people in need in the aftermath of a WMD-like event in the homeland, so that were they called to support civil authority, those governors or local state jurisdictions that might need our help, that they would be responsive and capable in the aftermath of an event like this, end quote. On Capitol Hill, questions about how the Pentagon determined that a thinly stretched military with two conflicts underway could spare these troops.
That's a misuse of assets. Those assets can be deployed, I think, more efficiently somewhere else when you have the guard that you can call up on a moment's notice.
Historically, the posting is unusual. In modern history, Army troops have been used at extraordinary junctures. Under the first President Bush, to contain the 1992 riots in Los Angeles, under President Lyndon Johnson in response to Detroit's 1967 riots, and in the grips of a depression by President Herbert Hoover to contain Army veterans demanding their bonuses. All actions, says historian Robert Dallek, undertaken by
unpopular presidents on edge about their capacity to lead, to evoke public support for whatever it is they think needs to be done.
Lisa, the Army Times journalist tells us that the story has generated intense public interest. And 4 weeks into a flurry of questions about the report, the Army finally contacted her and they requested that she publish a clarification that containing domestic civil unrest was not part of the 1st Brigade mission.
Luis Giovanni, thank you very much for that report. The American Civil Liberties Union is demanding information on the Army Brigade's deployment. It claims, quote, this deployment jeopardizes the long-standing separation between civilian and military government.
That is from Lou Dobbs and CNN. That was broadcast last Friday, October 24th, on CNN, Lou Dobbs. And the channel on YouTube that posted it up, Red Pill for You, notes that there are major public concerns of martial law in the United States. There's been so much legislation passed since 9/11 to get complete control over the U.S. Anyone can Google the references in that video and find the truth for themselves, and that's that we've been under martial law incrementally since 9/11. We're well now into hour number three of this special expanded edition of MediaMonarchy.com. It's episode 98, and we're going to now move into a massive heading of EnviroHealth, biodefense, flying syringes, and vaccine protests. First, from the Washington Post, huge new biodefense lab is dedicated at Fort Detrick. The Department of Fatherland Security dedicated a massive biodefense laboratory in Frederick, Maryland, moving toward the facility's opening despite questions raised about the risks of deadly pathogens to be studied there. When the National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures Center at Fort Detrick is fully operational in March 2009, about 150 scientists in the lab will be tasked with protecting the country from a bioterrorist attack through prevention or containment. Another goal is to allow investigators to fingerprint biological agents such as viruses and bacteria, quickly tracing their source and catching the offender. But critics cite the case of Bruce Ivins, a researcher at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRID, also at Fort Detrick, as evidence that such installations might help bioterrorists get access to lethal agents. FBI investigators think Ivins, who committed suicide conveniently in July, was responsible for the 2001 anthrax op. And again, they're saying that they can, of course, protect and prevent and contain outbreaks from the only people who know how to make this shit. Well, we made it, so we know how to protect you from it, unless, of course, we're running a drill and we accidentally, quote-unquote, accidentally release some. KansasCity.com has the story about emergency declarations, smooth way for vaccine makers. We have covered that previously. Again, retroactive immunity. If you happen to croak from the flu shot or anthrax shot when we make you line up for mandatory vaccination at the Superdome during some national emergency, Big Pharma can't get sued. NaturalNews.com has a story about the FDA conspiring with the chemical industry to declare bisphenol A, BPA, harmless. The FDA has been caught red-handed conspiring with the chemical industry to conclude that bisphenol A, the plastics chemical, is harmless to human health. As revealed by the Environmental Working Group, the FDA based its evaluation of BPA on a report authored by the American Chemistry Council, ACC, a trade group that represents chemical companies and plastics manufacturers. The FDA's evaluation concluded that BPA was perfectly safe for consumers of any age, including infants. This conclusion stands in direct opposition to the Canadian government, which declared BPA to be a toxic chemical on October 18th and moved towards banning the chemical in baby bottles. Even the U.S. National Institutes of Health says BPA may be dangerous, admitting it is concerned about BPA's, quote, effect on development of the prostate, gland, and brain, and for behavioral effects in fetuses, infants, and children. Officials fear Greyhound bus passengers exposed to tuberculosis. That from CTV.ca. And on the disturbing elite eugenics op, let's go to the AFP. Bill Gates funds research into flying syringe mosquitoes for vaccines. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation awarded $100,000 each to scientists in 22 countries, including funding for a Japanese proposal to turn mosquitoes into, quote, flying syringes delivering vaccines, linking to the Washington Post. The charitable foundation created by the founder of software giant Microsoft said in a statement that the grants were designed to, quote, explore bold and largely unproven ways to improve global health. Tying in with that, coming from techflash.com, Bill Gates' mysterious new company. Just months after his Microsoft farewell, Bill Gates is quietly creating a new company, complete with high-tech office space, a cryptic name, and even its own trademark. Public documents describe the new Gates entity, BGC3 LLC, as a think tank. That's BGC3 LLC, Limited Liability Corporation, as a think tank. It's housed within a Kirkland office that the Microsoft co-founder established on his own after leaving his day-to-day executive role at the company this last summer. Is this Bill Gates' next big business? A Gates insider gives an emphatic no, saying it's not a commercial venture, but rather a vehicle to coordinate the software mogul's work on his business and philanthropic endeavors. However, BGC3 will also oversee Gates' personal pursuit of breakthrough ideas in science and technology. The insider said the goal isn't necessarily to create new companies, although ideas could be passed along to Microsoft, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, or others, as it makes sense because they need to fund things like flying syringes filled with yummy vaccines for brown people in the eugenics op, as they also give their money to the Doomsday Seed Vault in Svalbard, Norway, Monsanto. A disgusting one from the Philadelphia Daily News. Vet's body was harvested in scam. Philadelphia Daily News by way of military.com. To the heartless thieves who stole body parts, he was a number. BM04J132. To Charlene Ann Williams, that number was her only son and her world. Jason Charles Hasbrook, Hasbrouk, a highly decorated soldier who participated in the Mogadishu rescue and in a dangerous Haiti mission, then died at 30 of a debilitating pituitary tumor which had left him blind. But no foreign enemy could have desecrated this American hero worse than three co-defendants sentenced in Philly in a national body parts for sale scam. Cutters pillaged Hasbrook's body of skin, bones, tendon, and other tissue without consent after his organs had been donated to others upon his death in 2004. Then, Gerald Garzone, G-A-R-Z-O-N-E, or Garzone, because he looks like a fucking greaseball gangster douchebag. There's a photo for you. Gerald Garzone, a funeral home operator involved in the scam, folded an American flag, which he turned over on an urn of Hasbrook's ashes to his grieving parents. 2 years later, Williams, a lieutenant at Pike County Prison, discovered what happened to her son. "I lost my breath," she testified. "The room started spinning. I started to sweat. I became one of the families who I had cried and prayed for only 2 days earlier." Again, we were speaking a moment ago of eugenics. State Representative, I believe this is out of North Carolina, State Representative Larry Womble pushes for victims of eugenics to get compensation. This from the Winston-Salem Chronicle. WSChronicle.com. State Representative Larry Womble will lead a meeting in Raleigh to explore the possibilities of the state providing compensation for the victims of a notorious eugenics program that forcibly sterilized thousands of people. The public meeting on the House Select Committee on Compensation for Victims of the Eugenics Sterilization Program happened in the legislative building in, I believe, Winston-Salem. So it's bizarre sometimes. I use Google Reader to sort through all the RSS feeds, and sometimes it's websites, but sometimes I just have searches on words, some of the key words, such as 9/11, JFK, and eugenics. There's a bizarre amount of stories that somehow contain the word eugenics, again, as it seems like it's time for the revelation of the method. These things are all being put out in your face. But again, eugenics was never out of our face. It was a big thing, but now we know about the end game, if you will. A bizarre story out of Pennsylvania, but one I imagine we'll be seeing much more of, and it of course reminds me of Todd Haynes' film Safe. Pennsylvania woman ordered out of her chemical-free bubble. 10 hours a day, every day, Elizabeth Feudale Bowes confines herself to a galvanized steel and porcelain shed outside her house. Inside are a toilet, a metal cabinet, a box spring with the metal coils exposed, and a pile of organic cotton blankets. Aluminum foil covers the window. The place is as austere as a prison cell, but it's also her sanctuary from an outside world that she says makes her violently ill. She and her husband call the structure the bubble. The bubble, though, may be about to burst. A federal judge has ordered it taken down by the end of the month. Some of the couple's neighbors in suburban South Whitehall Township complained that the 160-square-foot building is unstable and so unsightly it could drag down their, I'm sure, wonderful property values. The couple also hooked up electrical, water, and sewer services without securing permits. That's where they'll get them. New Jersey flu shot mandate for preschoolers draws outcry. This from the Associated Press as flu season approaches. Many New Jersey parents are furious over a first-in-the-nation requirement that school children get a flu shot in order to attend preschools and daycare centers. The decision should be the parents, not the states, they contend. Hundreds of parents and other activists rallied outside the New Jersey State House last Thursday, decrying the policy. Remember, it's not a law, it's their policy. And you go for it. Hundreds of parents lined up outside the New Jersey State House last Thursday, decrying the policy and voicing support for a bill that would allow parents to opt out of mandatory vaccinations for their kids. This isn't an anti-vaccine rally. It's a freedom of choice rally, said one of the organizers, Louise Habakas. This one-size-fits-all approach is really very anti-American. Steve Watson at Infowars.net weighs in with protests as New Jersey declares flu vaccines mandatory. Hundreds of concerned parents participated in demonstrations outside the New Jersey State House in protest of the state's decision to mandate flu vaccines for young children. Protesters also turned out to support a bill that would, of course, allow for conscientious objections to forced vaccinations, arguing that medication should be the choice of, the parent, not the government.
Vaccines, one of the most important advances in public health in the last 300 years. But despite the track record of vaccines, a heated debate raging right now in the United States over the safety of vaccines and a possible link to autism and other disorders. Louise Kuo Habakas and Claudine Liss want legislation passed in their home state that leaves the decision to immunize kids up to the parents, not the state. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. So you both live in New Jersey.
Yes.
And there is now a law on the books, correct, that says that kids will be mandated to have a slew of vaccines, including, I think this is what got people, the flu shot, right, Claudine?
That's correct, Gretchen, yes.
And this would be from 6 months to 5 years old?
Correct, 59 months old, yes.
All right. Why do you have a problem with that?
I have a problem with it because of the chronic illness that we currently have in this country. We have an epidemic of asthma in our children. We have an epidemic of allergies. We have an epidemic of autism. 1 in 6 children have a developmental disability in the United States, and we are not taking a hard enough look at the mandated vaccine schedule.
All right. So I know what you're going to say is that you believe that there's a link between the mercury that is in some of these vaccines, although many of them it has been alleviated now, and some of these disorders, right?
Mercury is absolutely a concern. It is the second most potent neurotoxin known to man, but this issue goes much broader than mercury. There are a number of ingredients in vaccines that are severely toxic and have not been safety tested adequately. I think if parents knew this and they understood that the kinds of tests that you would want for your children have not been performed, I think they'd be asking and demanding a lot more questions and demanding the research.
Does the flu vaccine really protect kids? Time magazine asks that question. But the AP says that most health workers skip the flu shot. Operating room nurse Pauline Taylor knows her refusal to get a flu shot is based on faulty logic, but ever since she got sick after getting a shot a few years ago, she's sworn off the vaccine. I rarely get sick. The only thing I could narrow it down to is that I'd gotten the shot, said Taylor, who works at university hospitals and clinics in Iowa City. I know that it's not a live virus. It just seemed pretty coincidental. Nearly 60% of healthcare workers fail to get a flu shot. Quickly now, because there's other more important things to get to. This from CNBC and posted up from Anunnaki 2006 on YouTube.com. This is one of the more amazing things I think I've ever heard said on CNBC from a financial insider.
At least you're getting back to the point where you can start to look at fundamentals, and that's good news. What happened?
I think you're in a liquidation phase. I think Kirsten had it exactly right. I think there's a bunch of wrong-footed moves by Hank Paulson and the Illuminati of the country, if you will, and I think we're paying for it right now.
CNBC guest says the Illuminati is behind the stock market crash. And he's right. And it's important to note, and fortunately, right alongside there is an article from The Independent out of the UK, the Rothschilds and their 200 years of political influence. Nat Rothschild, the financier at the center of allegations that threaten to engulf the shadow chancellor, George Osborne, is no stranger to laws which forbid politicians from accepting donations from abroad. Political donations from overseas are also illegal in the U.S., where John McCain's campaign team is under investigation for allegedly accepting a benefit in kind from two mega-rich British citizens, namely Nat Rothschild and his father, Jacob, the fourth Baron Rothschild. In April, Mr. McCain passed through London and spoke at a fundraiser dinner for expatriate Americans, where seats at the cheapest tables cost £500 a head. What caught the eye of Judicial Watch, a Washington-based foundation dedicated to combating corruption, was that the event was held, quote, by kind permission of Lord Rothschild and Honorable Nathan Rothschild. At the family home in Spencer House, St. James, the only privately owned 17th-century palace in central London. The U.S. Federal Election Committee, FEC, is still investigating the allegation that McCain's campaign team broke electoral laws by accepting a benefit in kind from the Rothschilds. We haven't heard from the FEC yet and don't expect to until after the campaign, Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch said. The Rothschild family and politics have been intertwined for generations, ever since Nathan Rothschild, who founded the English branch of the family business, financed Britain's war against Napoleon 2 centuries ago. Nathan was the son of Mayor Rothschild, who founded the family business in the Jewish ghetto of Frankfurt during the 18th century.
This is Frankfurt, Germany. 50 years after the Bank of England opened its doors, a goldsmith named Amschel Moses Bauer opened a coin shop, a counting house, in 1743. And over the door, he placed a sign depicting a Roman eagle on a red shield. The shop became known as the Red Shield Firm, or in German, Rothschild. When his son, Amschel Meyer Bauer, inherited the business, he decided to change his name to Rothschild. Amschel soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Mayer Rothschild had 5 sons. He trained them all in the skills of money creation, then sent them out to the major capitals of Europe to open branch offices of the family banking business. His first son, Amschel Meyer, stayed in Frankfurt to mine the hometown bank. His second son, Solomon, was sent to Vienna. His third son, Nathan, was clearly the most clever. He was sent to London at age 21 in 1798, 100 years after the founding of the Bank of England. His fourth son, Carl, went to Naples, and his fifth son, Jacob, went to Paris. In 1785, Mayor Amschel moved his entire family to this larger house, a 5-story dwelling he shared with the Schiff family. This house was known as the Green Shield. The Rothschilds and the Schiffs would play a central role in the rest of European financial history and in that of the United States. The Rothschilds broke into dealings with European royalty here at Williamsthal, the palace of the wealthiest man in Germany, in fact, the wealthiest monarch in all Europe, Prince William of Hesse-Cassel. At first, the Rothschilds were only helping William speculate in precious coins. But when Napoleon chased Prince William into exile, he sent £550,000, a gigantic sum at that time, to Nathan Rothschild in London with instructions for him to buy consols, British government bonds, also called government stock. But Rothschild used the money for his own purposes. With Napoleon on the loose, the opportunities of wartime investments were nearly limitless. William returned here sometime prior to the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. He summoned Rothschild and demanded his money back. The Rothschilds returned William's money with the interest the British consuls would have paid him had the investment actually been made. But the Rothschilds kept all the past profits they had made using William's money. Nathan Rothschild later bragged that in the 17 years he'd been in England, he'd increased his original £20,000 stake given to him by his father by 2,500 times. By cooperating within the family, the Rothschilds soon grew unbelievably wealthy. By the mid-1800s, they dominated all European banking and were certainly the wealthiest family in the world. They financed Cecil Rhodes, making it possible for him to establish a monopoly over the diamond and gold fields of South Africa. In America, they financed the Harrimans and railroads, the Vanderbilts and railroads and the press, and Carnegie in the steel industry, among many others. In fact, during World War I, J.P. Morgan was thought to be the richest man in America. But after his death, it was discovered that he was actually only a lieutenant of the Rothschilds. Once Morgan's will was made public, it was discovered that he owned only 19% of J.P. Morgan companies. By 1850, James Rothschild, the heir of the French branch of the family, was said to be worth 600 million French francs, 150 million more than all the other bankers in France put together. He built this mansion called Ferrières, just east of Paris. Wilhelm I, on seeing it, exclaimed, "Kings couldn't afford this. It could only belong to a Rothschild." Another 19th century French commentator put it this way: "There is but one power in Europe, and that is Rothschild. There is no evidence that their predominant standing in European or world finance has changed."
The Rothschilds and their 200 years of political influence. That clip, of course, coming from the legendary three-hour documentary, The Money Masters. If you have not watched that, you're doing yourself a great disservice. It's busted up into parts. That's part 7 about the Rothschilds. The Money Masters will really help you get an insight and background into the money creation industry. One quick bit of military technology police state news before we finish it off with Selection 08 news. Robots will hunt non-cooperative humans in the Army plan. This first from Danger Room. The Army is looking to develop software and hardware that will let packs of robots chase down, quote, non-cooperative human subjects. The machine team would be 3 to 5 robots, each about 220 pounds, led by a flesh and blood officer. Well, at least until the robots have the brains to intelligently and autonomously search for subjects on their own. Then the Army promises the machines won't just be good for hunting would-be John Connors. They'll take on more beneficial tasks, too, like, quote, search and rescue, firefighting, reconnaissance, and automated biological, chemical, and radiation sensing. See, nothing to worry about at all. From New Scientist... .com. Packs of robots will hunt down uncooperative humans. The latest request from the Pentagon jars the senses. At least it did mine. They're looking for contractors to provide a, quote, multi-robot pursuit system that will let packs of robots search for and detect a non-cooperative human. One thing that really bugs defense chiefs is having their troops diverted from other duties to control robots. So having a pack of them controlled by one person makes logistical sense. But I'm concerned about where this technology will end up, given that iRobot last year struck a deal with Taser International to mount stun weapons on its military robots. How long before we see packs of droids hunting down pesky demonstrators with paralyzing weapons? A good, astute observation from NewScientist.com. Now, presidential selection 08. Palast, hypnosis, Afghanisurge, riots, hoaxes, and more. First, amazing investigative journalist Greg Palast was on Headline News CNN to discuss the alleged Acorn accusations.
The right has spent the past few weeks accusing the community organization group Acorn of voter fraud on a massive scale, and the left argues those claims are phony baloney. Meantime, the left suggests the GOP is suppressing voter registration, and the right retorts, not true. So I don't know what to believe anymore except this. We, the American people, do not want to be hassled when we go to vote, and we don't want to revisit that mess of 2000. Here to figure all of this out, Tom Fitton, president and chief spokesman of Judicial Watch, and Greg Palast, writer at Rolling Stone, who wrote a very insightful article on the GOP's attempts to allegedly suppress the vote for some in this election. Greg, let's start with you. We all lived through the hanging Chad nightmare of 2000. Are we going to experience that again? And this time, will it be not just in Florida, but across the nation because of something called HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, which you feel has been hijacked by the right? Why and how?
The whole nation has been fluoridated, Jane. What's happened is I'm the reporter that broke the story about how before 2000, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush knocked off tens of thousands of black voters off the voter rolls, calling the felons criminals, when in fact their only crime was voting while black. Now that same method of mass purging is going on in all the swing states where Republicans control elections machinery, like Colorado. I mean, not many people know that 19.4%, that's one out of five voters in the state of Colorado, have been vanished off the voter rolls. New Mexico, one in nine votes.
How do they do that? I mean, they're just erasing it? I can't imagine that.
Yep. It's a purge. They call it list maintenance. They're getting rid of suspect voters. They have a brand new system under what's called the Help America Vote Act, which George Bush signed. Now George is helping us vote, if you can imagine that. And one thing that they're doing is they're checking names on voter rolls against government databases, and when there's a mismatch, you're gone. In fact, but what we're finding is that the voters that are losing their vote have such names as Velez Mitchell. If you were in Colorado, you wouldn't be voting, baby.
All right, not a chance.
Let's remember that the 2008 presidential selection is probably already stolen, detailed well enough by Greg Palast and RFK Jr. GregPalast.com and RFK Jr.'s article, Block the Vote. We're going to get into the bizarre Illuminati hand signal speculative area for a moment. This coming from BrutallyHonest.org. Obama's use of hidden hypnosis techniques in his speeches. And there is a massive PDF paper that goes through all this. Brutally Honest writes, the evidence is here. This document contains over 60 pages of evidence and analysis proving Barack Obama's use of little-known and highly deceptive and manipulative forms of hack hypnosis on millions of unaware Americans, and reveals what only a few psychologists and hypnosis, or NLP, neuro-linguistic programming experts know. Again, BrutallyHonest.org writes, please pass along your newly acquired knowledge of this and ensure that as many people as possible are exposed to it over the next 2 weeks, now being, of course, 2 days. And in the interim, remember that Barack Obama booked primetime air, as we mentioned, the infomercial on all major networks the week before the election, this 30-minute block of time on primetime TV, costing hundreds of millions, presumably to seal the deal for the last pitch. And that's his last chance to have a private mano-a-mano moment with as many Americans as possible as he can ensnare and snare into watching his last big, big performance. Jumping across the pond for the always interesting international perspective on the American scene, theglobeandmail.com. Obama favors U.S. troop surge in Afghanistan. Sounding presidential, Senator Barack Obama said Wednesday he would order a surge, that's the Afghana surge, if you will, of U.S. troops, perhaps 15,000 or more, to Afghanistan as soon as he reached the White House. Quote, we're confronting an urgent crisis in Afghanistan, Mr. Obama, the Democratic contender and now clear frontrunner to replace Bush, said Wednesday. It's time to heed the call for more troops. That's why I'd send at least two or three additional brigades to Afghanistan, he said in his most hawkish promise to date. A U.S. Army brigade includes about 5,000 soldiers, the number of combat brigade soldiers now here in America with the NORTHCOM assignment. A U.S. Army brigade includes 5,000 soldiers along with tanks, armored personnel carriers, and helicopter gunships, seeking to deflect attacks that he is dangerously inexperienced in foreign policy. Mr. Obama, huddled with a high-profile panel of experts, ask the experts, before a news conference aimed at showcasing his command of global affairs. Quote, "The terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 are still at large and plotting," he said, echoing Mr. Bush's oft-repeated refrain. He's right, though. The terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 are still at large and plotting. They're plotting how they're going to stay in power. Again, the international interesting perspective, now from telegraph.co.uk. Police fear riots if Obama loses U.S. election. Again, playing the divide and conquer card for all of us. Law enforcement officials say the intense public interest and historic nature of the vote could lead to violent outbreaks if people are unhappy with the results, encounter problems casting their ballots, or suspect voting irregularities. Police departments say they cannot rule out disorder and are mobilizing extra forces and putting SWAT teams on standby. In Oakland, near San Francisco, police will have actual tactical squads, SWAT teams, and officers trained in riot control on standby, saying, quote, "We always try to prepare for the worst," said Oakland Police Department spokesman Jeff Thomason, saying again, quote, "This election is going to mark in history a change in the presidency. We're going to have a woman in the presidency or an African-American president, their vice presidency. Good Lord. I think everybody around here is voting for Obama, so if he gets in the White House, everybody is going to be happy. But we'll have our SWAT teams on standby and traffic teams here, so if something goes off, we'll organize and take care of the problem." And then, speaking of problems and all these bizarre attacks, and we wonder who's actually doing them and who gives them all the attention, and are they hitting your own gang? Are they regular old false flag attacks? And it's our first note this time on all the bizarre things that have seemingly been going on in Missouri. But first, Missouri vandals kick, stomp, and steal Obama signs.
It's probably the most ridiculous thing that I've come across.
One Missouri lawyer is hoping his detective skills result in a conviction. Mike Brown put a sign in his front yard with his pick for the next president. The only problem, someone kept stealing and vandalizing the signs. So Brown installed a surveillance camera in hopes of catching criminals in the act, and that's exactly what he did. The video shows a woman getting out of a truck, then kicking and stomping the Obama-Biden sign. Police say this type of vandalism happens every election year. If the criminals are caught, they can be prosecuted for stealing or defacing property.
Just a guy who has a sign in his yard. And this is the first election I've ever felt was important enough for me to voice my opinion through a yard sign.
Now they note, of course, that this happens in any election, but now it's all weighted and baited, if you will. And it's funny, the guy says, but this is the first time I ever felt strong enough to have the commitment of putting a sign in your yard. Good job. So now, quickly, in seemingly unrelated what the fuck is going on in Missouri news, Missouri students create Hit a Jew Day.
Parkway West Middle School officials say sixth grade students decided to have what are called spirit or camaraderie days. One day it was Hug a Friend Day. The next it was High Five Day. On Monday, some students declared it Hit a Jew Day.
That turned to a whole different level when a number of students, a small group of students, took it to a slapping a person day.
Two kids were hit or tapped on their arms. Another was slapped in the face. All are Jewish. One mother said her son wasn't hit, and he brushed it off, but she didn't.
I was appalled and outraged, and truly, I can't even begin to say how horrible I felt.
Principal Linda Lalonde called an assembly Tuesday and turned the incident into a teachable moment. She talked about inappropriate behavior, religious and cultural diversity, and the Holocaust. Lalonde says a small group of students is responsible for the incident, and they'll face disciplinary action. And she's disappointed in those students who watched but did nothing.
We come and talk with you about how to treat each other. We talk about this all the time. And I said, nobody came to me in the last week to tell me something's going on.
They came for the Jews, and I didn't protest because I wasn't a Jew. So that's a bizarre, unrelated note of what the fuck is going on in police state Missouri. Now, however, one of the bigger hyped up stories of the last week, they're all hoaxes on some level. This one, however, is a real bona fide hoax. McCain camp hyped hoax. And this is the hoax attack tale. So the McCain camp hyped attack hoax before the actual truth, I think, came out. This raw story, a spokesman for the McCain campaign gave reporters an inflammatory version of Thursday's hoax story about a McCain volunteer being attacked by a man who carved a bee into her face, Pittsburgh's KDKA reported. Long before any facts about the Ashley Todd case had been established, McCain's Pennsylvania campaign communications director told reporters the alleged attacker had told the woman, "You're with the McCain campaign? I'm going to teach you a lesson."
Breaking news, within the past half hour, we have learned from Pittsburgh police that a volunteer with the McCain campaign made up a story about being attacked and having the letter B, presumably for Barack Obama, carved into her face. Renee Kaminsky is with NBC affiliate WPIX, or WPXI, I beg your pardon. She's been following the story. Renee, I understand you just got out of a news conference with Pittsburgh police. What can you tell us?
That's right, Kevin. Just about 15 minutes ago, officials here at Pittsburgh Police Headquarters told us that Ashley Todd confessed that she made it all up. They had brought her in this morning to work on a composite sketch of the so-called suspect, and a couple of detectives poked her head in the room, you know, sort of chatting her up, and she admitted that she made it up. She said, "I just want to tell the truth. This whole thing has started snowballing, and I didn't expect this," and she admitted to making it up.
But by all means, the biggest story that we're following for you right now has to do with what turns out to be a hoax, a story that we here at CNN chose yesterday not to go with because it seemed like either A, an isolated incident, or B, and maybe both, an incident that needed to be really thoroughly vetted and checked out before it was reported by any news organization. Unfortunately, it was reported by several news organizations, and as a result, the story is now looking like it has to be turned around. It's about this young lady. Her name is Ashley Todd. She is 20 years old. You see that bee there on her cheek. Her story is that yesterday, while she was at an ATM in Pittsburgh, she was taking out money when she was robbed by a, quote, big black man. 6'4", she said that he was. Apparently, that man, she went on to say, held her to the ground, attacked her, and then carved that B on her cheek. She called the police, reported it, and since then the story has been going around talk radio and several news organizations. It is now being reported by police in Pittsburgh that the story was a lie.
It was a hoax. It was a lie. As many are. Quickly, now, one last pre-election word from former Republican candidate Ron Paul, when asked by CNN's John Roberts to talk about what will happen to the Republican brand if they lose the presidential election, Ron Paul, of course, correctly notes that the Republican brand is in big trouble.
55 minutes after the hour, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan on Capitol Hill yesterday said he did not see the economic crisis coming. A lot of economists say that his policies were at least partly responsible for the big housing bubble that went kaboom and has now left us reeling with credit crunches and with the Dow Jones Industrial Average expected to go down yet again today. Here to talk more about this, Congressman Ron Paul, former presidential candidate, joins us this morning from his home in Texas. Good to see you this morning, Congressman. Yesterday, up there on the Hill, Alan Greenspan basically saying, "Oops, I missed this one. Sorry about it." But he was optimistic for the future. Let's listen to what he said.
"This crisis will pass, and America will reemerge with a far sounder financial system."
Congressman Paul, do you even listen to him anymore?
I have to, because somebody like you might ask me a question about him. No, I don't really listen in the sense that I'm going to get a lot of new information. I used to listen to him when he was writing back in the 60s because he agreed with free market economics and no respect for the Federal Reserve. Lately, though, I mean, he's been part of it. And right now, he's really gotten bad because what he was saying yesterday was that the only place where he might have made a mistake is he didn't advocate more regulations. Well, if you're a true free market person. It isn't the lack of regulations trying to regulate and improve on the conditions that the government creates. I mean, we created this problem. The Federal Reserve created this. The Community Reinvestment Act created. The FDIC created. The Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac created. It was all seen there. But now he says, oh, if we could have only had more regulations, right, we could have salvaged this flawed system.
The last pre-election word you'll hear from Ron Paul here on MediaMonarchy.com. Not presidential, but related just in political corruption nonetheless. Bloomberg has now been cleared to run for a third term. So we reported that he was trying to change the laws a couple weeks ago. Now, thinkprogress.org reports the New York City Council voted to extend term limits so that Mayor Michael Bloomberg can run for a third term next year. The council's vote of 29-22 undoes the result of two voter referendums that had imposed a limit of 2 4-year terms for the mayor's office. So what it basically just said is the New York City Council overturned twice the will of the people to do what the gangsters and banksters want. Here's the Bloomberg statement on the vote. Today, the majority of the city council decided to give the people of New York a fuller choice in the November 2009 election. I believe that was the right choice, and I want to spank Speaker Quinn for her leadership, and the blah-bitty-blahs on. Back to Think Progress, the New York Times reports that after public advocate Betsy Gottbaum announced the final result, in the balcony council chamber erupted in shouts of "the city's for sale" and "shame on you." And now, with much shame on you and them, we're going to finish out this last pre-presidential selection episode of MediaMonarchy.com with the latest episode of Collateral News. It's called "Why Whitey Can't Vote." So when a guy with an Obama monkey joins a McCain-Palin rally in Johnstown, PA, and nobody addresses him, you get an idea of what's happening. So this clip, this latest episode of Collateral News, shows a cross-section of racist remarks throughout the American hinterland.
When we're at war with the Arabs, we do not need a damn Arab traded in.
As a lifelong Caucasian, I'm beginning to think the time has finally come to take the right to vote away from white people. At least until we come to our senses. Seriously, I just don't think we can be trusted to exercise it responsibly anymore. You want proof?
Do you think he's a terrorist?
I think he's a one-man terror cell.
Obama and his wife, I'm concerned that they could be anti-white, that he might hide that.
Frankly, I think he's a Muslim.
These people are ruining it for the rest of us white people that are ready to move on. Sure, they have their reasons. He's a Muslim. He's a terrorist. He's a Muslim terrorist. He's going to fire all the white people and give their jobs to blacks. But those are just the little white lies these people allow themselves to be told. A self-induced cognitive dissonance that lets them avoid saying the unsayable. I cannot pull the lever for a black man.
It's a little Hussein. Little Hussein wanted to see truth and good Americans.
Hey, some people just aren't ready yet. Even Governor Ed Rendell said so. Just like some people aren't ready yet for computers or setting the clock on the VCR. Or to hear Congressman John Murtha tell it, some people, specifically some people in western Pennsylvania, will never be ready. But the fact is, if you did a statewide headcount of racists, you'd find just as many in eastern Pennsylvania as you would in western part of the state. That's why this ban on white people I'm proposing is going to have to be nationwide. And I'm sorry to say it's going to have to include all white people, even those who would vote for Obama. Because you can't just let some white people vote and not others. That would be unfair.
Barack Obama, the second most highest paid person from Acorn, who registers dead people.
Under my plan, the following voter types will not, repeat, not be allowed to vote this time. The angry male voter. This voter is mad as hell and not going to take it anymore, goddammit. He votes in a blind rage, growling and spinning tornado like in the voting booth like a Tasmanian devil himself. And what is he so mad about? What isn't he mad about?
I'm mad. I'm really mad. And what's going to surprise you, it's not the economy. It's the socialists taking over our country.
The scared voter.
These cats have bloodlines.
These include, but are not limited to, the so-called security moms. Just like the conservative is a liberal that's been mugged, the security mom is a soccer mom that's been 9/11. Their vote is guided by a little Casper the Ghost voice inside that says, Islam's weird and trying to kill me.
Just the whole Muslim thing and everything. I mean, everybody's still kind of, a lot of people have forgotten about 9/11, but...
The values voter and the flag pin voter. Ah, the God, guts, and guns crowd. These are people who vote every 4 years solely to beat back the ever-encroaching homosexual menace. It's a dirty job keeping the fags down, the nastier side of the Lord's work, if you will. But somebody's got to do it. As Sinclair Lewis so famously said, when fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross.
Spread the word. God hates Barack Obama. God hates Joe Biden. God hates this doomed nation.
And are you American?
Fear God.
Are you American?
Fear God. Give him the glory, for the hour of his coming draws nigh.
I got a little surprise for you. The left-wing liberal media have always been a real close knit.
By this point, you either think that I'm joking or calling me an elitist. I assure you, I am neither. You see, I come from Pennsylvania's coal belt. I am, in fact, just two generations out of the coal mines. I know those people. I come from them. They're not just some shameful abstract demographic to be brushed under the rug of euphemism by Wolf Blitzer and his ilk. They are armed because they are scared. They mean well, but they are easily spooked. And I fear for what is to become of them after the campaigns leave town for the last time, and Scranton and Allentown and Carlisle and Johnstown all go back to being the long, dark chicken dance of the national soul they were before the media showed up.
I think you may have noticed that Senator Obama's supporters have been saying some pretty nasty things about Western Pennsylvania lately. And you know, I couldn't agree with them more.
Hey, Salem tradition. This old union's got problems.
Jesus. Somebody help us, my friends. That's the last bit of news on this last episode, pre-selection 08, as we're now 3 days away, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 4 days away. Let's hope that that video from Collateral News does not give a eerie forecast of the tone of what's going to happen in not only the next 4 days, but the next four or more years. So all I got to say, you know where I stand. I say vote your heart. I say vote third party. And ultimately, I'll say, like the Simpsons said, don't blame me. I voted for Kodos. My friends, we're going to wrap up this 98th episode of MediaMonarchy.com on Halloween 2008 with a list of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. We had the City and County of Denver, Colorado, Google, Federal Government, Denver, Occult. We had the U.S. House of Representatives out of Manassas, Virginia, Google, Media Monarchy. Corporate Risk International in Reston, Virginia, Googled Civil Unrest, 2008 Presidential Election, U.S. Royal Holloway and Bedford New College in the U.K. hit me up from a link on what really happened about the death of 9/11 eyewitness Barry Jennings. Boeing out of Chicago Googled B-52 Guam crash blog. The London School of Economics, again, Barry Jennings. Royal Canadian Mounted Police reading about Top All 5. The North American Union, the SPP, and the 2010 Olympics. Oregon Public Education Network out of Medford Googled, why is there a curfew for minors in the state of Oregon? And with the notable exception of spelling minors as if they were working in coal, they meant to get people under 18. I was not aware about a curfew in Oregon, so you should Google, why is there a curfew for minors in the state of Oregon? CIBC World Markets and Investment Bank out of New York City Googled AIPAC and Freemasons. The Ho Chi Minh City Post out of Vietnam Googled sterilization stamp. The Dow Jones out of Piscataway, New York Googled Robert Bayer, Bin Laden, and Media Monarchy is the first result. Boeing out of Seattle Googled Obama parallel to fascism. J.P. Morgan Chase out of New York reading about the Grim Reaper that visited with the Marines at a Georgia college protest. General Electric out of Fairfield, Connecticut Googled Ron Paul long haul lyrics, which you should Google as well. That's Roy Shivers' awesome song, Daniel Abramson, of falseflagnews.com, Ron Paul for the long haul. Lockheed Martin out of Denver visited, and they were reading about how Gerald Ford ratted to the FBI about the Warren Commission members who were not convinced that JFK was shot from the sixth floor of the depository. And there you have it, my friends. And the next time I talk to you, we will have much to discuss. And that's going to do it for episode 98. Let's keep our fingers crossed that we can at least have some sort of semblance of peace and a peaceful transfer, and that we will not have another blatant stolen election. So we shall see next Friday on episode 99 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.